Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 17, The Three Doctors.
Look, you lost the image, not me.
I did not lose the image.
I said it. You saw it.
Look, both of you.
Look.
Ah, there you are. I seem to be stuck up here. Oh, so you're my replacements. A dandy and a clown. Have you done anything?
Well, we've assessed the situation.
Just as I thought. Nothing.
Well, it's not easy, you know.
Not as if we knew what that stuff is.
No.
Then I'll tell you. It's a time bridge.
So what? I see.
Now, what's a bridge for, eh?
Well, crossing.
Right. So stop dilly-dallying and cross it.
Wait!
You faded him again.
I did not fade.
Yes,
you saw him.
I ask, but who was that?
Me!
I have, as ever, at the other end of a light beam in an antimatter universe, a shapeless, wobbly servant of Omega, Martin.
Hello, Jim. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Yourself?
Not bad. I was going to try and imitate the noise that they make, these gel guard things, but I can't quite summon it up.
Just wobble your jowls, that'll be enough.
My jowls? My bowels?
Then wobble your bowels.
Okay.
Anyway, enough of that. On with the Three Doctors. Shall I give a bit of context to this one, Marty?
If you must.
I feel that I must, so I will, yes. It's the first story of Season 10, so we're deep into Pertwee territory at this stage, and it's the Barry Letts producing Terrence Dick script editing team, that era of the show. The writers are Bob Baker and Dave Martin, who you may remember from quite a few podcasts ago, wrote The Claws of Axos. Director this time is Lenny Main, who did both Peladon stories and The Hand of Fear in the Tom Baker era. The Three Doctors was filmed in November 1972 and transmitted at the very end of December 1972 and obviously carrying on through January. It's, as I say, the first story of Season 10, so the last time we saw the Doctor was in the Mighty Time Monster.
It's quite a quick turnaround there, isn't it? Unusual for the times, I guess.
Yeah, very, very quick, isn't it? Filming 1 month and broadcasting at the end of the next month. You can understand why people got quite stressed by the whole thing. I don't mean the viewers. I mean the So, on to the plot then, Martin. Would you like to start?
Yes, okay. We open with a character called Ollis, who's found this weather balloon that's landed down by a lake. It's actually filmed at Springwell Reservoir in Hertfordshire. But it's supposed to be a wildlife sanctuary, isn't it? Minsbridge Wildlife Sanctuary. He approaches this balloon. Attached to it, there's this kind of orange battery-type device, isn't there? He's carrying with him a shotgun. I'm not quite sure why. It's in a wildlife sanctuary, as he goes around shooting the wildlife. But
he shoots poachers, I think.
Does he?
In the face.
So, good. I'm surprised, actually, that the poacher didn't appear in this story, as it's a Pertwee era.
Well, if I saw Sam Seeley prowling about and I had a shotgun, I know what I'd do.
While he's looking at this strange device, we see a Land Rover driving over a bridge by a canal, and it approaches this wildlife sanctuary, pulling up at a cottage. In the Land Rover is a Dr. Tyler, and he's met by Mrs. Ollis, who points him towards her husband. She's a bit worried that this balloon has dropped sort of chemicals into the area because it's a wildlife sanctuary. But he kind of tells her not to worry about that, and he heads off to go and see Ollis.
That's an interesting point, because she's got a very dodgy Wes Country accent, hasn't she? Yet we know that because of, I think, the speed that Dr. Tyler gets to Unit HQ, that they're not actually that far away from London.
Yeah, it was a bit of a problem with Doctor Who, isn't it? That 2 points, really. First, anybody outside of London has always got some sort of a yokel accent.
This string tied around their knees.
Yeah, and the other thing is that it seems to take no time at all at times, and then at other times it will take them forever, dependent on what the plot requires, really.
Yes,
But it's a fictional place, isn't it? So I guess it could be anywhere, really.
Yeah, it's top secret as well, although everyone seems to know about it. Yeah, so Tyler drives over to the area, and he and Ollis actually see each other, don't they? At least you can see Ollis kind of seeing the Land Rover.
Hmm.
And later Tyler says that Ollis waved him, although that's not actually seen on screen, is it?
No.
As this happens, there's a crackling noise from the orange sort of box device, and Mr. Ollis disappears. And the birds all fly off in panic. It's a kind of a lightning flash sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of like a white flash. And as Tyler pulls up in the Land Rover, he calls out for Ollis, but he's not there. He kind of looks around a bit, and then he uses the radio in the Land Rover and asks to be put through to Unit HQ, which is a bit of a strange thing to do, really.
Well, they are a top-secret organisation, and Brigitte, a little bit later, seems to be a bit fed up with Dr. Tyler not treating it in that way. He seems to have a unit on speed dial, doesn't he? Even though it's top-secret, and he's not part of unit. It just seems a bit strange.
Well, we find out in a little while, you know, what this weather balloon is supposedly is, don't we? It doesn't seem to connect with unit in any way. It's a bit bizarre that he immediately calls them. Anyway, but that's what he does.
He does, yeah. And the next scene, we're in Unit HQ, and Tyler is talking to the Brigadier in person and the Doctor. And then Joe Grant brings in some empty coffee cups, which they pretend to drink from.
Mm. Yes, I think it's the invisible tea that the Doctor has just...
He's perfected it at last.
Yeah, excellent. Tyler's telling the Brigadier and the Doctor about what's happened, doesn't he? Joe asks what this machine is, because it... Actually, he's got this orange box sitting on a desk in the laboratory, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's obviously brought it with him. And he tells Joe that it's cosmic ray research. Tyler asks the Doctor to pass his briefcase, and he gets some papers out of that, and he says he's been getting some strange results on some tests that they've been carrying out on this cosmic ray research thing. He shows the Doctor first an X-ray, which apparently is normal, and then a second one where it shows a much narrower image, doesn't it? And the Doctor seems quite amazed at this.
Yeah, it looks a bit like a kind of lightning strike, doesn't it, on the photographic plate. The readings show that this beam seems to be travelling faster than light, which is not considered possible. And it seems to have come through millions of different star systems and seemingly directed straight at Earth. And it's a nice little bit of business here, isn't it? The Brigadier asks if there's anything he can do to help. And the Doctor asks him to pass him a silicon rod. He does this, and the Doctor stirs his coffee with it.
Yeah. Again, a little bit earlier than that, Tyler takes some more papers out of his briefcase and sort of shows it to the Brigadier, who kind of says, you know, you're better off showing it to the Doctor.
Yes, quite right. Yeah, so the Doctor thinks this beam is compressed light, a controlled superlucent emission. You had one of those the other night, didn't you, Martin?
I did. But, you know, I recovered from it, so it was all right.
Good, good. All cleaned up, I hope. Anyway, he takes Joe with him to investigate the spot where Bloom landed and where this box was found. Meanwhile, Tyler is getting on to develop the final plate that's inside the box, the monitoring devices, we find out it is. He helps himself to the equipment a bit, doesn't he? He sort of makes himself at home. Mm. And Brigadier gets quite disgruntled, and this is where he starts talking about it being a top-secret organisation. Yeah, treat it as your home. Liberty Hall, Dr. Tyler. Liberty Hall. Storms off.
Yeah, so Tyler takes the developed kind of X-ray thing from the machine and he holds it up and there appears to be some kind of face in it, doesn't it?
Mm, quite chillingly.
Yeah, and he starts to tamper with this orange box and, of course, it crackles. There's a white flash and he disappears.
Mm.
So that's two of them gone.
Yes, and worse than that, a strange CSO-based organism emerges from the box, doesn't it? And slimes its way out of the box and onto the table, and then down the plug hole of a nearby sink. I thought it was actually quite a good effect, this, for something sort of otherworldly and some sort of, you know, kind of energy of some sort, isn't it?
Yeah.
From an antimatter world, in fact. It is colour separation overlay, but the actual object that they treat with it is a feather boa, which is a nice 1970s thing to use, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's one of Jimi Hendrix's old ones.
Could well be. More likely to be Joe's, though.
Hmm.
But yeah, I agree, actually. It is a pretty reasonable effect. For once, they get the use of CSO right, I think.
Hmm.
It doesn't look awful. we do get a fairly awful bit of CSO a bit later on in the story, don't we?
We do, yes.
And also some pretty ropey effects, but we'll get onto that in a fairly short time, actually.
Yes.
So we're back with Mrs. Ollis, who is showing the Doctor and Joe where the balloon landed. The Doctor has some sort of kind of a Geiger counter. It's actually a solid screwdriver, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, he's got it on a particular setting, isn't it?
It's emitting a noise like a Geiger counter, isn't it?
Mm.
So he's obviously picking something up, some sort of radiation. He asks about Mr. Ollis. She doesn't seem too bothered, does she? She says he often goes off on his own and we won't see him until after dark. She offers to go and look for him for them, but the Doctor says, oh, no, don't worry. And she leaves. Joe sort of says to the Doctor that she should worry, shouldn't she? And he sort of says, yeah, she should.
Yeah, so the Doctor suspects something pretty terrible is going down.
Mm.
Back at Unit HQ, Brigadier's irritated to find Dr. Tyler gone. And he gets Sergeant Benton to look for him, believing him to be wandering around the top-secret unit headquarters.
Mm.
Outside, Doctor and Joe arrive back to Unit HQ in Bessie. There's some awful, jaunty, primitive synthesizer music at this point, isn't there?
Yeah, yet again, we're let down by some music.
Yes.
Bizarrely, actually, as they sort of approach you in HQ, there's a sign, isn't there? It's got the Brigadier's name on it, which is a bit odd.
Yeah, do you think the personnel would be fairly top secret as well, for terrorists and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
His name is emblazoned on the front there, never mind. Incidentally, the exteriors of the Unit HQ are filmed at the YMCA hostel in Denham Green, Buckinghamshire. And in a lovely piece of continuity, that's the same location they used for Unit HQ in 1983 for the Five Doctors.
That's amazing. Well done, JNT.
Mm.
Not said very often.
Not by us, anyway.
Anyway, Joe and the Doctor get out of Bessie outside the front of the building. But as Joe steps down, she notices this strange blob thing coming out of a drain. Quite startled by it, isn't she? But the Doctor shouts at her to get behind Bessie as the blob kind of, the whole of it comes out of this train. And she clambers over Bessie, showing us her knickers.
Hurrah! Worth your admission to be alone.
Indeed. They run and hide behind a tree as this blob does its flashing trick and disappears Bessie. And then it goes back down the drain again.
Yeah, so the Doctor and Joe return to the lab. In the lab, Sergeant Benton is telling the Brigadier that Tyler's missing. They can't find him when they've had a look around for him. But he also mentions that there was an explosion coming from the garage area, which is where all this happened with the blob and Bessie. The Doctor comes in at this point and tells him it was actually a flash of light rather than an explosion. It was a release of kinetic energy. He tells Benton that the drain needs guarding, and Benton, somewhat puzzled, goes off to do just that.
Yeah, the Brig tells him to put the men on standby, doesn't he?
Yes.
The Brigadier has had a call from Mrs. Ollis saying that her husband hasn't returned, so they obviously now know that something's definitely up with him. The Doctor picks up the plate that Tyler had developed, and he says that the face on it is Ollis, and the Brigadier says that Tyler's also disappeared, and that the orange box thing was open when he came in. So the Doctor gets his sonic screwdriver out again and sort of waves it around near the sink, and when he goes over the sink, it really crackles, doesn't it?
Yeah, he gets a very strong reading at the sink. The Doctor looks at Tyler's reports, and it seems that the lightning has been scanning the Earth like a searchlight and picked on them, specifically the Doctor. Joe reminds them about what happened to Bessie disappearing, and they come to the conclusion that it's actually chasing the Doctor because it seemed to lose interest in Joe when the Doctor appeared.
Yeah, did it?
Not noticeably, I don't.
You know, you don't pick that up at all, do you, from what's shown on screen?
No, you don't. But I mean, it requires a bit of exposition, doesn't it, to get that point across, because it doesn't happen visually. But
no.
The Doctor believes his blob has got a very strong hunting instinct, but as we say, it's not really that efficient in actually swallowing up its prey. It swallows up quite a lot of other extraneous material, but not what it's actually after.
Yeah, the Doctor thinks that Ollis and Dr. Tyler were both mistakes, and indeed Bessie, because the blob is after him rather than them.
Yeah, he says that you know, the doctor had been in Bessie, so that's why that went, and Tyler was in the doctor's lab, and that's why he went. It doesn't really explain why Ollis disappeared, other than it being confused, which seems a bit feeble.
Yeah. Actually, the whole plot line with Ollis is just pointless anyway. He doesn't add anything to the plot at all.
No, it doesn't.
But we'll probably talk about that a bit more at the end. The Doctor thinks that the light beam was the means of getting this blob to Earth, and he says that if they wait around long enough, the blob will find them.
Yes, at that point there's an electronic fart from Dudley Simpson, which is nice. Outside, things start to hot up a bit, don't they? Some strange sort of man-sized blobs appear, don't they? Which have become to be known as gel guards, haven't they? But they're not actually named at any point during the story on screen. To such an extent that me and my brother used to call them gel guards.
Well, me and my brother used to call them girl guides.
Girl guides. Okay, yeah, that's complicated, that one. Mm. But yeah, we had them in the Doctor Who Monster book. I don't even remember that. So that was written down, and of course we never heard it said, so we used to call them girl guards.
Mm.
But that's just being slightly backward, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Speaking of which, Corporal Palmer at this point makes his presence known and says, "Holy Moses, what's that?" when he sees these gel guards appear.
Mm.
When was the last time you said Holy Moses, Martin?
Well, Tuesday, I think.
Tuesday? Oh, okay. So yeah. Fairly common for you then. I haven't really heard anyone else say that.
Well, the tube was actually on time.
That's why no one ever says it.
But yeah, it's quite a comedy moment, really, isn't it? But these gel guards just kind of blink into existence, don't they?
Yes.
But they make this kind of noise that sounds a bit like they've got indigestion.
Yes.
And they kind of wobble around a bit, don't they?
Yeah, they shuffle. I mean, it's clearly these shuffling feet underneath the bodies. And it's a bit like the crinoid, actually, we were talking about in the Seeds of Doom podcast.
Mm.
Anything that doesn't have sort of humanoid legs is actually quite hard to do, I think. And so it's proved here. They do actually make Mr. Blobby noises, don't they?
I was reading something somewhere earlier today and they likened it to the soup dragon in the Clangers.
Actually, that's pretty close, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, odd. But Sergeant Benton arrives and he forms the soldiers into two groups. They start shooting at these jail guards. The bullets seem to have no effect on them. But it seems that jail guards are armed themselves. They've got this sort of one pincer each, haven't they, which pulsate with light, don't they, and cause explosions.
There's another great line from Corporal Palmer when Benton arrives and he asks how many of them are there. And he says, "Don't know, Sarge. They seem to be springing up all over the place." It's just dreadful.
He never returned, did he, Corporal Palmer?
No, I think he was... It's almost the same level of acting as we had in the last podcast from Lee John, I think.
Hey, now hang on. Don't be too hasty. The Doctor notices that the blob and the gel guards are from the same source. The blob was the scout and then the gel guards the reinforcements. And Brigadier seems impressed with the military nous of whoever's sending these creatures.
Yeah, it's just, their grasp of military tactics is very good. What, just wobbling about a bit? I mean, the Brigadier is particularly stupid in this story, but I'm sure UNIT must have better military tactics than wobbling around.
Are you sure?
Possibly not, actually. I'll take that back.
We haven't seen a lot of evidence of that. The next bit is that Sergeant Benton is coordinating the defence of UNIT HQ. He's got his elbow a few inches from the line of fire of a soldier behind him. He was rattling away, unloading while Sergeant Benton is directly in front of him with a rather hot elbow. One of the soldiers does a direct hit on one of these jail guards with a bazooka, and they kind of congratulate each other, and then he just carries on walking, so they realise that whatever they've got in terms of force is not going to be enough. And the Brigadier orders a complete evacuation.
Yes, the Brigadier leaves the Doctor and Joe in the lab, and the CSO blob comes out of a grill in the wall, doesn't it?
Mm.
Doctor's telling Joe that she needs to evacuate as well. I don't mean her bowels.
You might have done that already if she's that scared.
But, of course, being Joe, she says she wants to stay with him. at which point Benton climbs in the window, and then the blob does its flashy thing, and a huge chunk of the wall and the door disappear, don't they? And they all jump into the TARDIS to get away from it. And the Doctor puts on the force field. You get a great bit of acting here from Benton.
Yes, John Levine.
He's kind of looking around the TARDIS in amazement because this is his first time inside the TARDIS. And the Doctor actually asks him if he's going to say, is it bigger on the inside? And he says, well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it, really?
Good answer, isn't it?
Yeah, he says that nothing about the Doctor surprises him anymore. He kind of just takes it in his stride. Typical of Benton, I think.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, pretty level-headed sort of bloke. Just say jump in, more unit furniture gets swallowed up by this blob, doesn't he? He's doing quite a removals job at the moment. The Doctor tries to take off in the TARDIS, but he can't. And quite oddly for the Doctor, his next step seems to be sending a distress call to the Time Lords.
Yeah, this bit is a bit strange. He tries to take off, knowing full well that he can't take off because, you know, he's grounded on Earth. Why would he suddenly be able to take off?
Well, he might be trying to take off and land somewhere else on Earth, but I don't think he's even able to do that, is he?
Well, no, only he's tried some experiments, like in Inferno he manages to do it, but he just seems really surprised when nothing happens, you know, and he shouldn't be.
He should be used to that by now. It's been a couple of seasons without time travel, without time travel that he's been in charge of anyway. The Time Lords move him about like a pawn every now and then, don't they?
Exactly. As you say, he sends us a distress signal to the Time Lords, which is, again, a bit of a strange thing to do, although obviously the plot calls for it, so that's what he does. He says that the blob has immobilised the TARDIS, and that's the reason why he couldn't take off. But as I say, surely the reason he can't take off is because he can't fly it.
Yeah,
the Time Lords have taken away his ability to fly.
Indeed, yes. And more of that right at the end, isn't there? And then we get a scene in a control centre on the planet of the Time Lords. This planet is as yet unnamed. The name Gallifrey doesn't appear until the Time Warrior at the beginning of next season, isn't it? The Time Lords appear to be trying to help the Doctor. They're giving the Doctor's TARDIS all the power that they can spare, but they've been unable to identify what the blob is, and they seem to be losing power in general on the planet. They've found the source of the beam, though, and then we see on the screen a cartoon of a black hole.
That's hilarious. It's like a 1950s Flash Gordon effect, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's dreadful. The other funny thing about this scene is there's a Time Lord who's kind of at the controls of this monitor, and it's Richard Stilgo.
You think there's a little piano keyboard there? That you
can exactly.
Just have a go at.
Spitting image of Richard Stilgo.
It is very, very similar, yeah. But as I say, the Time Lords have problems of their own. There's a massive energy drain, which, because of what the Time Lords do, is threatening the fabric of the universe. And they believe a power equal and opposite to their own from the realm of antimatter is causing this. This comes out mainly from a conversation between the President, played by Roy Purcell, and the Chancellor, played by Clyde Pollitt. The Chancellor is saying that someone should help the Doctor, but the President says that no one can be spared. They're all trying to sort out this energy drain. But he says the Doctor himself could be spared. In other words, previous incarnations of the Doctor. The Chancellor doesn't like it, does he?
No.
The Doctor meeting his previous selves transgresses the first law of time. And he gets sort of quite indignant about it all, doesn't he? And tells the President, be it on your own head.
Yeah, there's a couple of things worthy of note here. First of all, the Chancellor's voice, which is just hilarious.
It's a high piping voice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Then they say that they can't spare anyone to go. How many of them are there? There's about three people in this room, and I think there's a couple of other extras, isn't there? Surely there must be other Time Lords around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are, but apparently they can't be spared for whatever reason. They can't all be doing the same thing. But yeah, it doesn't quite ring true, doesn't it? But it's a sort of clumsy device of getting the other incarnations of the Doctor involved, isn't it?
Exactly.
It could perhaps have been handled slightly better.
The other interesting bit, you got the Chancellor and the President, and the President seems to be, the way he addresses the Chancellor, he calls him his Your Excellency, doesn't he? So the Chancellor appears to be of a higher rank than the President.
Yeah, I thought that. And in later depictions of Gallifrey, the President is the top man, isn't he?
Because I couldn't figure it out to start with, who was who. The only one that's actually named is the Chancellor. The President isn't actually called the President at any point.
No.
The only way you can work it out is from the titles at the end.
Yes.
you know, so I was waiting for the titles to figure out who this other person was, and it said president. I was like, well, who's the president then? Because it can't be him, because he's calling the other one Your Excellency. But yeah, that appears to be the order of things.
Yeah, it seems slightly confused, because there are chancellors that we see later on, aren't they, in other depictions of Gallifrey, who are definitely subservient to the president.
Mm. So a bit of a weird setup.
But... it is, yeah, a bit like Varos, actually, isn't it? Same sort of thing happening in Vengeance of Varos.
Mm.
Yeah, speaking of previous incarnations, we then see Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor, on the screen. And Troughton appears to be escaping from some sort of explosion or something, doesn't he, on screen. There is a bit of a myth about this. There's a kind of long-held view that this is a little snippet taken from the Macra Terror, one of his earlier stories in his role as second Doctor. But in fact, it was filmed specifically for this story, The Three Doctors, so that's a myth exploded.
Hmm. Inside the TARDIS, we hear the materialisation sound, don't we? And a recorder appears out of thin air on the TARDIS console. The third Doctor picks it up and he passes it to Cho. They're kind of wondering what it is. And then Troughton appears, plucks the recorder out of Joe's grasp, kind of appears just out of thin air, doesn't he?
Mm.
And he asks accusingly if Pertwee's been trying to play it.
Yes.
And then he comments on the fact that the TARDIS console room's been done up. And he says he doesn't like the new decor.
Which is a very similar comment to the one he uses in The Five Doctors about Unit HQ, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, you've gone the place up. Don't like it.
He turns the scanner on and it shows these kind of white flashes that the blob is obviously still outside trying to vanish everything it can. And then he turns it back off again. But bizarrely, he makes a big show of flicking this switch or whatever to turn the scanner on and off. But it appears to already be on anyway. And it doesn't go off when he finishes it.
No. Is he patching the audio through or something like that? I don't know. He doesn't seem...
Is that what he was doing? I'm not sure.
It might be. I didn't notice particularly. But yeah, he does make a very big show of doing it. He probably pulls a knob off, doesn't he?
Then Benton finally reacts, saying, Doctor, where did you spring from? But it's about 2 minutes too late.
Yeah, it's funny. You actually see him walk behind Troughton. And Troughton has quite a bit of... Although it's a monologue, really, because no one answers. He just says several things on his own. And then Benton, yeah, chooses that point to speak, but speaks with the amount of surprise you would use had he appeared a second earlier.
Yeah.
It doesn't work very well. The other thing is that Pertwee looks sort of annoyed rather than in any way surprised when the second Doctor turns up.
Mm.
There really is no surprise for him. I mean, Joe looks a bit puzzled, but Pertwee just looks instantly annoyed. Perhaps he was expecting something like that to happen and having put a distress call through to the Time Lords, but he must know that that's transgressing the first law of time as well, and that is not something that the Time Lords would do lightly.
Mm. Yeah, or maybe he kind of picked up on the clue of the recorder, although it was followed very quickly by Troughton appearing. Mm. So yeah, Benton and Troughton have a bit of... They greet each other, and there's some talk about the Cybermen, that they hadn't seen each other since that affair with the Cybermen, from the invasion, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the first of many tedious lines that we do in The Five Doctors. You know, who's he? Oh, he's me, and I'm him, and all this kind of rubbish. Which, I guess, if you're watching this for the first time, it's probably quite amusing, but when you've watched The Five Doctors before it, it is all very much the same, isn't it? And it does just kind of jar with me, anyway.
Yeah, me too, really. The whole sort of Doctor and previous selves sort of set up here, isn't it, for the first time, obviously, in The Three Doctors. It's the first time that any of the incarnations meet.
Mm.
And they all sort of argue with each other, and they seem to kowtow to the first Doctor, which again seems a bit odd. And all this stuff happens again in Five Doctors, doesn't it?
Mm.
But it's all kind of set up here, and it doesn't instantly make sense that the Doctor would argue with himself. I know they've got different personalities, even though it's the same man. It's much more interesting dramatically for them to do that than just to keep agreeing with each other, but it doesn't necessarily make sense, does it? But that template was set here. That's been used ever since.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind that. I think that's quite amusing, actually, the fact that they argue with each other. What annoys me is all this, you know, I am he and he is me and all that rubbish.
Yes, it does get a little bit tedious quite quickly. Troughton is actually quite charming to Joe, isn't he? He's trying to explain what's happening. He says, I may call you Joe, mayn't I? It's all quite nice. And he's right back into it, isn't he, Patrick Troughton? No trouble trying to recapture the character.
No, and he appears to already know a bit about what's going on, and he tells Pertwee about the Time Lords sending him. He says that their effectiveness is now doubled, to which Pertwee responds, halved more like.
We get the feeling that the Time Lords had that just pluck him out for his time stream and drop him there. You get the feeling there was some sort of conversation with the Second Doctor about what was going on with the Time Lords. Mm. Outside, while all this is going on, the Brigadier and a soldier confront the blob. The soldier shoots at it, and it eats the water cooler next to him.
Isn't it Corporal Palmer?
Sorry, it is Palmer again. It is, yeah.
Yeah, he does another, good grief, what's that?
Yes, he does, yeah.
And there's a really odd bit here where he seems to react to something in the wrong direction.
Did you notice that? No, I didn't know.
Yeah, he kind of opens fire, and let you say that the thing flashes and it water cooler disappears or something. And then it cuts back to him, and he's looking in a completely different way, reacting to, as if there's something else there.
I'll have to watch that again. While all this is going on, the doctors are in the TARDIS watching all this on the scanner screen. But to be honest, as a viewer, you can't actually see anything useful on the scanner screen, can it?
No, it's just doing what it was before, which is just showing these white flashes.
Yeah, but they kind of comment on what's happening. Anyway, there's a nice line here from Troughton, isn't there, when he takes Pertwee to one side and says, "They are very worried, you know."
Mm.
Delivered nicely. And then he puts the Third Doctor in the picture. They both say contact, and then you get very, very quick cuts, don't you, from Pertwee to Troughton, along with a little kind of sound effect. You get the impression that thoughts are being transferred from Troughton to Pertwee and perhaps back again. Then they start arguing about this blessed recorder, don't they? And all this is being watched by the Time Lords on their screen, and they think, this plan isn't going to work because they're not going to cooperate.
That's right. And the Chancellor or the President, I can't remember which one, of them asks to see the First Doctor, whose image then appears on the monitor. William Hartnell, of course. And he says that maybe he will be able to keep them in order. And back in the TARDIS, as Pertwee and Troughton continue to argue, Hartnell suddenly appears on the scanner screen. But he's in this kind of strange sort of glass pyramid, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's sort of in a kind of a void, isn't it?
Mm.
Behind him or around him.
Yeah. And he starts talking to them, asking them if they've done anything yet. They say, they don't even know what it is that they're dealing with. And Hartnell tells them it's a time bridge. And he says, you need to cross it. And then off he goes again. He disappears again back in his triangle and he sort of fades out of sight again. A few things here to say. I suppose we ought to talk about Hartnell. He sounds and looks very old. You know, it's well known that he was very ill when this was filmed. He only appears in kind of pre-filmed sequences, because he wasn't up to the rigours of a live shoot sort of thing. But, you know, I mean, he comes across okay. I mean, some of the lines, you know, you can tell he's just kind of reading them off a cue card type thing. But, you know, he puts in a reasonably good performance, I think.
Yeah, it's certainly worth having him there. I mean, it's not a complete dead loss, is it?
No.
I mean, he was originally scripted to be running around with all the other doctors, but obviously that couldn't happen because he was not well enough to do so.
No.
So, but he gets some good lines. He's, well, the dialogue is good for him. He said, "So you're my two replacements, a dandy and a clown."
Yeah.
And, of course, he's his usual sort of angry self. In fact, and I don't know if this adjective's ever been used about his performance before, but I found him quite irascible. I don't know what you thought.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, maybe you can get the copyright on that, because I don't think it's ever been used before.
Oh, I'll be rich beyond the dreams of avarice.
It's a bit strange that he immediately knows what's going on as well. Throughout this, whenever he appears, he instantly has the answers, which isn't really his character. Because if you think about his character when he was actually the Doctor, he was a bit of a bumbling old fool, really, most of the time.
Well, the whole idea of the show really was a kind of a voyage of discovery for everybody, wasn't it? It's only kind of later on that the Doctor knew the answers straight away. So you're right. I mean, that's not how he's ever been depicted on screen before. And it doesn't make sense, as we've said in the Five Doctors podcast, that the youngest of the incarnations of Doctor seems to know more about stuff than the older ones.
Mm.
And they defer to his opinion and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't really make sense just because he, as an actor, is older. Should make any difference. You know, he, as a character, is younger. But, you know, that's just one of the things that's set up here and it's been carried on ever since, really. Yeah, as I say, worth having him there. And it's a shame he wasn't more fit. But, you know, you wonder what the show would have been like had he been wandering around forgetting his lines.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know, really. I guess in some ways it's probably better that he appears as he does, really.
Mm.
Yeah, but I think it works.
Well, it's a good foil to the other two Doctors, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a disaster, definitely. In fact, might be better than, as I say, if he had been fitter and wandering about. Anyway, his image fades, and the two other Doctors blame each other for the image fading. And there's a tremendous bit from Troughton here, isn't there? One of them's got to go and cross this time bridge, so someone's got to go out and be zapped by the blob. They toss a coin, and Troughton tosses it, slaps on his hand, looks, and then covers it up completely and just says, "Hard luck," and then pulls this excellent expression.
Yeah. Yes. He turns the force field off, doesn't he? And Pertwee runs outside, and of course Jo immediately follows him because she can't be any further than 2 yards away from him ever. And as soon as they get outside, the blob flashes and the two of them disappear. And that's the end of episode one.
Yeah, decent sort of cliffhanger, I think, because at this point we don't know what's happening to anything that's been zapped.
No. And a pretty good episode one, actually, I think.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
Mm.
And of course, they're very new as well, because we're a bit blasé about multi-doctor stories now.
Mm.
This must have seemed very, very strange to the avid fan back in the day.
Definitely, yeah. Pretty intriguing stuff so far, and I was quite enjoying it.
Yeah, it's a good setup, I think.
Anyway, we start episode two, the recap, as usual, and Troughton closes the doors as Benton tries to follow after the Doctor and Jo. Troughton says that Pertwee knows what he's doing, and they look on the scanner, but obviously the room is now empty. And he says that they've obviously been transported somewhere. He says something along the lines of that they've gone to too much trouble just to have killed him. That this thing's gone to too much trouble. So he's obviously been transported rather than killed.
Yeah. So they look outside on the TARDIS scanner. Oddly, the TARDIS is in shot from the TARDIS scanner. So I'm not quite sure how they manage that. But the blob appears to have calmed down. And they go out and take a look. It does a little bit of a flex, and they dash back into the TARDIS in sort of Doctor and Jamie style, really. It's the second Doctor Jamie style, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then they kind of creep out again, and at this point the Brigadier appears, and he asks questions, I think, doesn't he, about the blob, and then he looks around and sees the second Doctor standing there. His face is absolutely priceless, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just says, "Oh, no."
Yeah. He asks why his appearance has changed again. We get a quick cut away to Pertwee and Jo, who have appeared in a quarry somewhere. Mm. But they're kind of lying on the ground, comatose, aren't they?
Yeah, this quarry's in Rickmansworth. Not in the story, obviously, but in reality. That's where the first episode of Earthshock was filmed. And it also was the place they used for Titan III in The Mighty Twin Dilemma. And the... I haven't watched Delta and the Bannerman since it was broadcast, but is it the Chimeran planet in the equally mighty Delta and the Bannerman? So, yeah, it gets a good workout and appears as several Doctor Who worlds, this quarry in Rickmansworth.
Yeah. Anyway, after this brief cutaway to Jo and the Third Doctor, we go back to Troughton and the Brigadier, and obviously Troughton's just explained to the Brigadier what's happened, and the Brigadier obviously doesn't believe a word of it. He questions him about the Yeti and the Cybermen from the two previous stories that Troughton's Doctor had with the Brigadier, and about him changing his appearance. But Troughton just says there's no point in asking him about it because it hasn't happened to him yet.
Fair enough.
Yeah, he says it's just some sort of temporal anomaly. But the Brigadier thinks that the Doctor's been mucking around with the TARDIS, which is what's caused this change of appearance. Benton tries to intervene, doesn't he, and put him right, but the Brigadier isn't having any of it, and he puts Benton in his place, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Sort of shouts him down. He basically says to Trout that he wants two things: an effective way of dealing with this antimatter blob and the safe return of Jo, and that as long as he does the job, he can wear whatever face he likes.
Yes, that's a good compromise, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. And at this point, the Brigadier suggests that he contacts his all-powerful superiors, which is a bit of a strange thing to say. He's never said anything like that before, has he?
No, and nor has the Doctor done that before, so yeah, it's a bit odd, isn't it? Speaking of the superiors, well, the Time Lords are still losing power, and if this continues, I think they'll lose their power of time travel, and so they're getting quite antsy about this. The Chancellor and President are arguing about the use of the Doctors. The First Doctor's transportation unit is trapped in the time eddy, that's why he's only appearing on the screen there. The President is aware that the Doctor 3 and Jo are over the absolute event horizon and in the black hole. to this, the Chancellor says, well, theoretically, they're dead.
Mm. But of course they're not. No. They're waking up in this quarry in Rickmansworth. Jo, though, does think that they're dead, doesn't she? But Doctor says that they're not. And he says it doesn't look much like heaven, does it? And they start to have a look around. And as they kind of wander off, you can see they're being watched by one of these gel guards who's kind of tiptoeing along the top of a rise.
Yes. Back at Unit HQ outside the TARDIS, some great stuff from the Second Doctor talking about antimatter. Mm. It's a brilliant line, isn't there? You can see the effect, but never the cause. It's like being punched on the nose by the Invisible Man. And the Brigadier says, then what's this stuff? And the Doctor says, the Invisible Man. Mm. Oh, so, yeah, this is a massive great blob of antimatter. Of course, antimatter cannot exist in the world of matter. When the two meet, there's normally a massive explosion. So the Doctor deduces that whoever sent this antimatter is clever than we are. Unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, and he then searches his pockets for something. The Brigadier goes off to contact Geneva, as he tends to want to do.
Yes.
Ben thinks it's been a bit too much for him, because he's kind of in denial about everything, isn't he, the Brigadier?
Mm.
Troughton wants to keep the antimatter creature confused, and he says he wants to feed it useless information. And he asks if there's a TV set handy.
Satire. Back on the strange quarry world, the Third Doctor and Jo are exploring, and they find the water cooler that was zapped and removed from Unit HQ. They also find the Brigadier's ancient reel-to-reel computer, a hat stand, the lab sink with the orange box on it, and Bessie, which appears to have been ridden around by somebody in the antimatter world because it's got white chalk all over the tyres, so rather than just being plucked out of the matter world and dropped the antimatter world, someone's been having a joyride around the quarry.
Yeah, and luckily they've left it on a gravel road as well, which is quite useful.
Yes, handy.
Quite a nice little bit from Jo, isn't it, when they get in and she says, come on then, and Kirby sort of says, where to? She goes, twice around the park? And off they go, being watched by another jail guard.
Before that, there's a nice little bit, isn't there? They find the sort of disembodied lab door with a bit of a wall around it, don't they?
Mm.
Jo goes around the other side and says, it's locked. And the Doctor says, well, it does say no admittance. It's a nice bit. Well, we get the annoying Bessie theme again, don't we, as they drive up.
Yeah.
So another treat.
There's a strange bit next. You get this alarming camera angle, don't you, where they drive along towards the camera, but it's a really slanted camera angle. And they jump out and they find these footprints. And they leave Bessie behind to go and investigate. And as they wander off, Ollis appears from behind a rock, and he's kind of watching them, isn't he?
Holding his shotgun, yes.
Mm.
Back at Unit HQ, the Second Doctor is with Benton, and they're working on a contraption that's supposed to confuse the blob, or the overgrown blancmange, as Benton calls it. The Brigadier arrives, having spoken to Geneva, and he's volunteered the Second Doctor to do a video conference to explain the situation to the Security Council, to which Troughton does one of his fantastic, oh, noes!
Yes.
He tries to get out of it by saying, well, how are you going to explain my change of appearance to them? You know, because they would expect to see the Third Doctor. And Brigadier says, oh, don't worry about it, I've sorted that all out. You're the Doctor's assistant. And he's horribly indignant about that, isn't he?
Yeah, that doesn't go down too well at all, does it? Anyway, they go off, don't they? They leave Benton behind guarding this blob and the this apparatus, and the Doctor tells him, you know, if it does anything, just give it a burst of whatever this machine does. He tells him to give it a small dose. Benton says, well, what if that doesn't work? He says, well, give it the lot. Benton's a bit kind of cheesed off about the whole thing, isn't he? And he takes some chewing gum out of his pocket and pops it in his mouth. And he throws the wrapper at the antimatter, which, of course, immediately reacts to it and starts going a bit haywire. So he twists the control on this thing and gives it a quick burst. And you hear this kind of crackling noise. But all it seems to do is make it worse. So he tries again and then starts shouting out, calling for the Doctor. And the Doctor and the Brigadier come running back in as this blob's really getting agitated, and they all dive inside the TARDIS just as it starts flashing again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good old Benton.
Yes, well done. He's made a bad situation worse. Inside the TARDIS, the Brigadier is, of course, dumbfounded, but immediately comes to the conclusion that the Doctor's been wasting unit funds and equipment on the TARDIS interior, which he believes to be an optical illusion. Troughton says, no, they come like this, really. That's a nice line. And then he offers him a jelly baby, which is always attributed to the Tom Baker Doctor, isn't it? But it happened way before he arrived.
Yeah, I think this is the first time it's actually used. Actually, yes, good old jelly babies. Back in Rickmansworth, Dr. Tyler is drawing in the sand and the gravel. He's muttering away to himself. He's drawn E equals MC squared in the ground, and he's doing some strange calculations in his head, and he seems to have worked out that he must have travelled faster than light to get there. God knows how he worked that out. And the Doctor and Joe arrive and see him. They go greet him, and he tells them what's been happening to him. The Doctor explains that they're inside the black hole, on a stable world in the universe of antimatter, and, you know, that it shouldn't really exist, but it does. And they start to wonder who it is that's brought them there.
Yes, and at that point, we see a robed and masked figure watching them on a screen somewhere, and it commands a gel guard to bring them to him. The gel guard appears, zaps at them, and they surrender. And all the time, Ollis is watching proceedings from a distance.
Yes, Tyler's telling Joe and Pertwee that he's seen these gel guards, and he's trying to describe them. And then some of them appear and start firing at them. It's quite a good effect, actually, isn't it? Because there's kind of a ring of explosions around them.
Yes.
Preventing them from running away. And sure enough, the Doctor kind of raises his arms above his head. Yeah, I was quite impressed by that bit, actually.
Yeah, it's a good little scene. Back at Unit HQ, the Second Doctor realises what's gone wrong. Instead of trying to pacify this creature, he's actually stimulated it. And he suddenly tweaks what's gone wrong, and he turns and looks into the Brigadier's face and says, "You fool!" Talking about himself, but straight into the Brigadier's face.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
And he works out, because the blob is antimatter, his pacifying process stimulated it rather than the other way around. So that's where he went wrong. He wants to have a think about what to do next, and he thinks he can think better to music, so starts searching for his recorder again. The Brigadier is getting furious about all this, and he wants to get out of the TARDIS and help his men, but the Doctor says it's too dangerous. "That thing out there has become a killer. It's my fault, and I'm sorry."
Yeah, Pertwee, Joe and Dr. Tyler are being shepherded towards Omega's palace, or this unknown person's palace. They get inside, and Joe says it looks a bit like Aladdin's cave. I thought to myself, well, it certainly looks like a pantomime set anyway.
Exactly, yeah. It looks like some kind of Cub Scout rendition of Aladdin. Yeah, it's a very, very poor set, something, I think, for something that's supposed to be so impressive. It's one of those cases, actually, where the novelisation does it so much better, doesn't it, because of its infinite budget.
Exactly.
And the whole thing is sort of made out of beaten copper or something, isn't it? I seem to remember that fabulous copper palace, isn't it? But it really doesn't look like that on the screen.
No, it's pretty poor, really. Tyler suddenly decides that he wants to make a break for it, despite Pertwee telling him that it's pointless doing it. The Brigadier is trying to call his men on the radio from within the TARDIS. Of course, the force field on, it's not possible for him to get through. But Troughton takes the radio from the Brigadier and he starts to try to adapt it so that he'll be able to use it. As he kind of takes the back off it and then bits fall out, the Brigadier kind of looks at him and, exasperated, raises his eyes to the heavens.
Yeah, it doesn't look very promising, does it? It's all so scattered over the console.
Yeah. Benton's saying he's worried about Joe and the other Doctor, but Troughton says that he actually envies them. They're obviously inside the black hole and having all sorts of fun.
Yes, back in the black hole, the Third Doctor wants to stay and meet their host. And Joe says that she'll stay with him, but Tyler, who previously said he was going to escape, agrees with the Doctor that if he tries to escape, he might endanger everyone's lives, and then escapes.
And probably runs for it there.
Yeah, it's real blatant padding here, isn't it? And apparently the episode was underrunning. And Tyler sort of wanders around, pursued by a jail guard. Then there's some padding conversation between the Doctor and Joe about the Doctor wondering whether he can persuade their host to send Joe and Tyler home. And then Tyler is eventually rounded up and is back with the Doctor and Joe. He says that was a bit of a waste of time, wasn't it? And I think everyone says yes.
Yeah. They're just kind of standing around anyway. Before that happens, they're brought in, and then they just stand around for a bit, doing nothing. And then Tyler does his runaway thing, and then he comes back again, and then they stand around a bit more. You know, what's going on? Is Omega doing his makeup or something?
Well, you know what these bigwigs are like. They like to make people wait around. Yeah, it's all one-upmanship, isn't it?
Maybe he got caught short and he was just squeezing one out before they arrived.
Yes, as you find later, he's got nothing to squeeze one out of, but... back in the TARDIS, Doctor 2 has got the Brigadier's sort of communicator working, but only after whacking on the TARDIS console. Brigadier managed to get hold of Corporal Palmer and tells him to sit tight. At this point, the First Doctor appears on the TARDIS monitor again, saying he's still trapped. He tells the Second Doctor that he can help him, firstly by turning off the TARDIS force field. And the Second Doctor doesn't really like the idea, but the First Doctor says, use your intelligence. After this conversation is finished and the First Doctor has faded off screen again, the Brigadier asks who it was. And the Second Doctor says, I'm afraid you'd never believe me. Yeah, one more Doctor in the mix would be too much of him to cope.
Yeah. Well, finally, Pertwee Joe and Dr. Tyler are moved on through the corridor. They talk a bit more about the antimatter universe. Pertwee says that their bodies have been processed in some way so they're able to exist there. And then there's this strange bit about not everything being always as it seems, and he starts doing some magic tricks, doesn't he? He pulls out a pencil, which he makes disappear, and then turn into a bunch of fake flowers.
Mm.
And he says that the world that they're on is like a conjuring trick. And he kind of discards the flowers on the floor. And then they're finally shown in to see their host.
Yes. Meanwhile, the Second Doctor says he's always had a great respect for the First Doctor's advice, and he turns off the force field to allow the blob to get at the TARDIS. Outside Unit HQ, Corporal Palmer and his men see all the jail guards suddenly vanish. Then Unit HQ vanishes, or rather, we've shown a photograph of it, and then we've shown a photograph of some surrounding grounds afterwards, haven't we? Which appears that the Unit HQ was built on grass rather than foundations. Not quite sure how that worked. Then we're treated to a photograph of Unit HQ being sucked into the cartoon black hole.
Yes, that's the end of the episode. We do get a couple of shots of the gormless Palmer's face, don't we, just before that as well?
Yeah, we do. We get the same shot replicated, don't we? It's a kind of fast zoom into his face, isn't it? Which we get twice rather than once. I was very, very young when this was first on, but I remember this happening and being quite scared that the whole building had disappeared. So, although it seems a slightly strange cliffhanger now, it's quite a good one, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Apart from the fact that the black hole effect is rubbish, the house going into it is quite effective, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're into episode 3 now. The Third Doctor, Joe and Tyler are taken into a kind of a throne room, and this figure appears out of a doorway, and he announces himself as Omega, to which the Doctor looks a bit astounded, and he says that Omega was destroyed, to which Omega responds, "No, Brother Time Lord, not destroyed, as you can see."
Yes.
He's wearing some sort of cape, isn't he, with kind of a shoulder piece, and he's got this big kind of golden mask on his head.
Yeah, he's very impressive, I think, Omega.
Yeah, I mean, the mask is impressive, very impressive, I think.
Mm.
Although not so a bit later on when it kind of flaps open, but we'll come to that.
But it's a nice moment, I think, when he kind of emerges from the shadows.
Mm.
And he's got a very impressive voice, isn't he? He's played by Stephen Thorne, who we've previously seen as Azal in The Demons. He also went on to play the male version of Eldrad at the end of Hand of Fear. In between, he played an Ogron in Frontier in Space, which is a bit like a climb down, isn't it, from Azal and Omega. You got to get your work away again,
I guess. Anyway, he orders Joe and Tyler to be taken away. He says that they have no part in his revenge. And then he starts banging on about feeling grievously wronged, and it's his time for vengeance.
Mm. Doesn't sound too promising, does it?
No.
Meanwhile, Joe and Tyler, obviously been separated from the Doctor now, led through some quite nasty CSO to a cell which appears not to have a door keeping them in. So Tyler is quite optimistic about their chances of escape. But then Joe sort of looks towards the door area, shouts, "Look!" And then sometime later, a doorway suddenly appears and blocks itself.
It's the usual problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's happened so quickly that she'd have to say, "Look," in the middle of it happening, and that would be very difficult to portray to the viewer, but the sort of gap in the wall, really, isn't it, rather than the doorway, just blocks itself.
turns into a sort of a grey wall, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Joe and Tyler start speculating about Omega. Joe comes to the conclusion that it looked like the Doctor and Omega are deadly enemies.
Omega is spouting on about without him there wouldn't have been any time travel for the Time Lords. There's a brief moment where the boom mic is in view in this scene, unfortunately. But the Doctor's saying that Omega knew that his mission was dangerous. And Omega says, yes, but he didn't expect to be abandoned. And it transpires that he was the solar engineer that detonated a star to give the Time Lords their power, you know, their ability to travel in time. The Doctor says that he is revered by the Time Lords and that he was feared lost when the supernova exploded. But Omega thinks that he was sacrificed and forgotten. The Doctor says he actually sees him as a hero, but Omega said that he should have been a god.
Yeah, it's a fabulous booming line, isn't it? A hero? I should have been a god!
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very good stuff. He's quite a scary character, I think, Omega.
He is. You don't want to, you know, rile him, really, do you?
No, you don't. There's a little bit more padding in the cell with Tyler and Joe. There's a padded cell. And then we get back to Third Doctor and Omega carrying on their chat and exposition. The Doctor's saying that all of Omega's world is theoretically impossible, but Omega disagrees and says, here, everything is possible, and he conjures up an elaborate chair for the Doctor to sit on. He then goes on to say that he survived through force of will. Uncharacteristically for Omega, he makes a joke, doesn't he? He says it was mind over antimatter.
And he tells the Doctor that he created the organism from the raw stuff of matter. That's what he sent across to the Earth to find the Doctor, and that this organism imbued the Doctor with the ability so that he could also exist in the antimatter universe. So we then find out why Omega's brought him there, and he apparently needs a Time Lord to do something for him. The Doctor sort of asks, does he think that he really can defeat the Time Lords? To which Omega responds that he already is, that they're almost out of power. And the Doctor says, well, what if I don't help you? He says, well, you will face the wrath of Omega, and so will your companions. Then this alarm sounds, doesn't it? And he goes off to have a look into this kind of screen nearby. And then he gives some orders, presumably to the jail guards, to go and investigate, because something has obviously happened, or something has appeared, as we're about to find out.
Yeah, it seems to be some more company has arrived, doesn't it? In the TARDIS, the Doctor, the Brigadier and Benton, clearly they jump up and down in the TARDIS, but it's edited to look like they're all just landing. And they appear to arrive at their destination. The Brigadier tries to use his communicator to contact Corporal Palmer, but the Second Doctor believes they're now out of range, and the Brigadier should prepare himself for a shock. The monitor reveals that the blob has gone. I mean, you still see the, you know, the rest of the room and the TARDIS again. But the blob has gone, so the Brigadier heads off out and a sort of reluctant Doctor follows him out of the TARDIS. The Doctor believes that the blob ate some of Unit HQ along with the TARDIS, like taking a pill with a swig of water. He thought the TARDIS was indigestible for the blob, unless he just grabbed the whole section of Unit HQ to go with it. The Brigadier wanders through the part of Unit HQ that's come with them and opens an exterior door to reveal a bunch of sand dunes. And he turns back with a fantastic look of incredulity, doesn't he? But he appears to look straight down the lens, doesn't he?
He does. He looks straight at the camera. Yeah, he almost comes as like a double take, doesn't he? Then he closes the door and storms back to the Doctor. He's really angry with him for stealing Unit HQ. He's saying, what am I going to tell Geneva? He says, we're probably miles from London, which the Doctor says, well, I think we're a bit further away than that. But the Doctor's more interested in going for a swim when he hears that there's sand outside, isn't he?
Yes.
Benton points out that, to the Brigadier that they're probably not even in the same universe, which goes to show that Benton's got more of a grasp of what's going on.
That's saying something.
And then we get the great line from the Brigadier where he says, nonsense, it's a beach, I'm pretty sure it's Norfolk. And then a little bit later he says, I'm fairly sure that's Cromer.
You get to pick a nice Cromer crab there for lunch. Yeah. Lovely. But yeah, there's another great line, isn't there, about he wants Benton, the Doctor, to say that they're stopping Unit HQ from being overrun with holidaymakers. He's wandered out, hasn't he, to find a phone and call the authorities. the second Doctor wants to find his recorder, but he and Benton get rounded up by some more jail guards, and Troughton comes out with one of his, oh, my giddy aunts.
Yeah. Meanwhile, out in the quarry, the Brigadier runs into Ollis, who, although he didn't reveal himself to the others earlier, he immediately...
Should hope not.
Yes, he flashes the Brigadier, and he tells the Brig that he's seen the Doctor and Joe, and that they were taken away by these jail guards. They duck down as Troughton and Benton appear being shepherded along by some more jail guards. And then they follow them to the entrance to the palace, which is just kind of a doorway in the kind of a sheer rock wall, isn't it? They're taken inside. Ollis turns to the Brigadier and says, "Now what, General?"
Yeah.
It's quite amusing. Brigadier says that, you know, they'll go and have a recce and then they'll mount a surprise attack. And he tells Ollis that he's now under his orders.
Yeah, he sort of requisitions Ollis, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Great stuff. I quite liked that opening in the rock. I thought it looked pretty good. And there's a little bit of model work, isn't there, for the great copper doors to open. It's the same technique as we talked about in Attack of the Cybermen, where you hang the model close to the camera. All the actors need to walk around it so you can't see their heads being cut off by something that should be in front of them.
Yeah.
But I think it looks pretty good, actually.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, meanwhile, Pertwee with Omega, he is advising Omega that if he doesn't reverse the energy drain, it could tear apart the fabric of the entire universe, which Omega says would be an interesting spectacle. Pertwee says that he could rejoin the High Council. If he went back, he'd be treated really well. But Omega says that all he wants is power. He doesn't want to bargain with the Time Lords.
Yeah, as he's saying, the spectacle of the universe being destroyed, he's used to solitude, so he doesn't really need anybody else to see.
No.
It's hard to reason with someone who feels that way. The second Doctor and Benton arrive in the throne room, being jostled along by these jail guards. The third Doctor tries to bluff them away as random bystanders who have just been zapped, like all these bits of UNHQ and Ollis and people like that. And he asks Omega to send them home. A nice little reaction, isn't there, from Troughton as the name Omega is mentioned. You just see him sort of start, because he's not speaking or anything, but it's a nice bit of acting when you haven't got a line, which is a sign of a good actor, I think.
Mm.
Omega goes on to boast about this organism being programmed to seek out a Time Lord, which makes you wonder why Ollis is there. You can explain away the others, because they were with a Time Lord at the time, but Ollis clearly wasn't. But Omega can't believe that the Benton or the Second Doctor, either of those, are Time Lords. Sadly, the Second Doctor gets a bit indignant about this, so Omega twigs pretty quickly that he is a Time Lord. And somehow it makes a huge leap of logic to come to the conclusion they're the same Time Lord, which I thought was a bit odd, isn't it? Because he knows about the laws of time and knows that it's extremely unlikely they would be allowed to be in the same place at the same time. And he found it difficult to believe that he even was a Time Lord. So how he jumps from that to thinking they're the same Time Lord saves time, I suppose, but it's hard to see how he gets to that conclusion.
Yeah, there's always this thing, though, with Time Lords, that they can recognise each other even when they've changed appearance.
Where it's convenient, you know, for the plot to do so.
Yeah, but the majority of the time they can recognise other Time Lords quite easily. And yeah, so it's possible that, you know, they would recognise when there's two that are the actually the same person, perhaps. But
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It does seem a bit of a leap.
Mm.
But Troughton's still trying to pretend that he's not a Time Lord, and he refers to the horrible great jelly that brought him in.
Yes.
Which I found funny. It's kind of almost lost the line, but it can make it out.
Yeah, the line is almost lost, is it? Because Omega is basically shouting, isn't it, at the time. He's got quite angry that both the Doctors have tried to deceive him. And I think it's really good, because obviously this is a universe, that, or a planet at least, that Omega has created. And when he gets angry, you hear thunder rolling in the background, don't you?
Yeah, that's good.
Really effective. And he hasn't decided what to do with them, but it won't be good, and they're taken away.
Meanwhile, outside, Ollis and the Brigadier have been looking around, but the Brigadier says that they'll have to wait for the door to open because they can't get in. Pertwee is complaining that he almost had Omega convinced to let him help him.
There's no sign of that.
No, there isn't.
Of him winning him over at all, is there?
And of course they start arguing again, and Benton and Joe basically chastise them, and they reluctantly kind of apologise to each other. And then they go completely the other way, don't they, and they're stepping over each other to let the other one speak first. Sort of.
There's quite a sort of failed piece of improvisation, I think, from Pertwee at this point, isn't there?
Is it? What was he doing?
He's just trying to say how he thinks that Omega's confused, and you can tell this is unscripted what he's saying, and it doesn't really work very well, but I think there's another conversation sort of going on alongside, so it's not that noticeable.
Yeah, there's some more, you know, who's this, it's me nonsense. And then Tyler was asking about antimatter and how the antimatter world can exist. And the two doctors both answer at once, and then, as I say, they're sort of offering for the other one to speak, etc. And they start talking about singularity. But Joe calls for them to speak one at a time and make it simple so that they can all understand what's going on. I think it's Trouton, is it? I can't remember. One of them, anyway, explains about singularity being a point in space-time that can exist only inside a black hole, and that Omega has controlled the forces of singularity using his will. But now that he wants revenge against the Time Lords, Trouton explains a bit more about Omega, repeating what we'd already found out in the previous scenes. There's a bit more padding here, really, isn't it? Because normally what happens with the companions is that they'll do this so that the audience knows what's going on. But unfortunately, yeah, the audience already knows what's going on, and you have to hear it again when the companions are being told. But there you go.
Yeah, I think there was the production team were a little worried that the concept was going to go over people's heads, so I think they thought it was worth showing on screen the doctors explaining what was happening again. I think that's why we get it again, because it is a fairly tricky concept to grasp, I suppose, particularly to 1970s people.
Sickos.
Anyway, they're talking about this world being created by Omega by a vast effort of his will, and they're a bit doubtful that they can actually stop him. Unfortunately, at this point, you get one of those bits where the camera moves from face to face with the people that he said this to. So you go from Joe to Tyler to Benton, and each one turns to their left to look at the next person, which I always think is a bit naff. But they go on to explain the story of Omega. We've heard all that before, as you say, but Jo is quite clever at this point. She says, if Omega can will up a whole world, surely two Time Lords can will up a small door. And so they do. They do their sort of contact mind meld again, and a door appears where the wall is blocked up, actually, in that cell earlier. The doctors leave, telling the others to stay there. Of course, inevitably, they follow. And there's a slightly clumsy exchange, isn't there, between John Levine and Katie Manning as Benton and Joe, but they managed to get out of the room.
Yeah, and as soon as they exit, the door vanishes again, doesn't it? Mm. And then we see the two doctors going through the corridors, and then the other three following, but they immediately have to hide from one of the jail guards that appears. Pertwee and Trouton find the singularity chamber. And again, we get a bit here where Pertwee says, after you, to Trouton, but Trouton wants to toss a coin. Pertwee grabs the coin in midair and pockets it, and he says, what will be the point? And he enters first, referring back to Trouton's trickery earlier on.
Yeah, it's a nice scene, isn't it?
They go through this kind of smoky doorway, don't they? And there's this hole in the floor with a column of smoke rising out of it, which apparently is the singularity. Amazing, eh?
Yes, fascinating, as they say. And then you hear the enormous bellowing of Omega shouting, what? Which is really, it makes you jump, actually, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Incredibly loud, and you're not expecting. And then he marches to what seems to be a designated point on the studio floor, doesn't he? Before he then turns to the doctors.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a little bit too stagey. But anyway, it gets there eventually and demands to know how the doctors are free. And the doctor says, by combining their minds against him. And he threatens that they'll do so again to destroy him if he doesn't let them plead his cause to the Time Lords. To which Omega says, well, you think you can challenge me, do you? Well, if you do, then you must fight the dark side of my mind. And then a very strange and unsettling scene that unfolds, doesn't it? Where the third doctor finds himself in this dark void, doesn't he? And a strange, sort of slow-motion, piggy-faced humanoid creature advances towards him.
Yeah, very weird. Joe, Benton and Tyler, they're still wandering around these corridors being chased slowly by these jail guards. Joe spots the doctor's discarded bunch of flowers and realises they must be near the main entrance. Sure enough, they find the door and they're struggling to open it as the jail guards approach, but they're helped from outside by the Brigadier and Ollis. They manage to open the door enough to all rush outside, and the jail guards appear and start shooting at them, but they manage to get to safety in the quarry.
Do you notice that the door's slightly less impressive up close than it was from that model shot earlier?
Yeah, definitely.
They look like mighty thick doors, don't they, from the model shot? And when they get to them, you know, about half an inch thick, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that undid the good model work previously, but never mind.
Mm. The Brigadier's still surprised about the fact that there's two doctors there. As they run, there's another attack from one of the jail guards, but they seem to be getting away. And then back in this void, the Doctor is grappling with this strange creature, and he manages to kind of throw it in a kind of martial arts manoeuvre, accompanied by this strange, eerie, almost silence, isn't it, with this kind of drumming noise, isn't there, going on.
Yeah, it's really quite eerie, isn't it? It's everything's sort of muffled and slowed down, isn't it, the sort of sound effects.
Yeah.
It's really quite odd. Back to the Time Lord control room, the first Doctor appears on the screen, a trifle tetchy. Or dare I say, irascible. The President tells him he must go into the black hole, you know, to help the others, because three are needed to defeat Omega 2, isn't enough? And Doc 1 sort of agrees very grumpily.
Mm.
And then we're back in the void, and Omega's... It's billed as Omega's champion, isn't it? I mean, in fact, it's not in credit at all, but it's kind of referred to everywhere I've seen it as Omega's champion. This is kind of,
yeah,
sort of an avatar of his will, isn't it? I think we get a repeat of some of the footage, don't we? They're continually throwing each other over their shoulder and that sort of thing. And I think it's exactly the same piece of film we saw earlier, but it ends differently because the Omega's champion, if you will, gets the Third Doctor in a kind of stranglehold. And then you hear in the background Omega bellowing, "Those who oppose the will of Omega shall not live. Destroy him!" And the episode ends.
Yes, good stuff. Troughton says that if he destroys him, he'll destroy his only chance of freedom. And then we get a shot of Pertwee on the floor, cross-eyed, gurning, clutching his neck, and he's helped to his feet by Troughton. Omega says that it's useless to defy him, and he tells them that the others are trying to escape as well, which they're surprised that they didn't stay in the cell when they were told to, like they always do.
Yes, of course, they always obey them to the letter, don't they? Yeah, sure enough, they are escaping, as we know. The Brigadier jumps into Bessie's driving seat, and the other four somehow get in there. I think Ollis is sat on the side of the car. And then the Brigadier, or Nicholas Courtney, I should say, kangaroos away, doesn't he? In Bessie, practically hurling everyone off.
Yeah. Great bit then with Troughton just trying to annoy Omega by prattling on about his recorder. And Omega responds by saying, "You wrangle and babble of pipes." Great line. He says that they all face destruction. Troughton's trying to test his patience, see if he can push him. Pertwee thinks it's a bit dangerous to do that, and they should be a bit more careful. And they're kind of whispering to each other, and that annoys Omega even more. He thinks they're plotting against him, which of course they are. But Troughton says he's thoroughly repentant. Omega goes on a bit more about having created this world and the singularity, but that it's not enough to release him. He's still trapped there. Yeah, he says that although he can transmit matter along this light beam, he can't actually transmit himself, as the whole world is there because he wills it into existence. As soon as he leaves it, there won't be anything there to be sending the light beam. So he's kind of trapped. He refers to himself being the atlas of his world. You know, he's holding the world up. So if he lets go of it, then it won't exist anymore.
It's a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? You know, he's got to abandon control to escape, but if he abandons control, he can't escape. So,
yeah.
It's really, really difficult. He's a prisoner of his own creation, as he says.
I think it's a very good idea, actually.
It's brilliant, yeah.
That concept.
Yeah, it's great. So the answer to this is to get one or more Time Lords to take over this control so that Omega can escape, which is a very similar idea to the Mind Robber, isn't it? The Master and the Mind Robber.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Well, he wants the Doctor to take over control of that imaginary world so that he can escape.
Mm.
But it doesn't feel that repetitious. But, you know, it works really well in this case because, as you say, he's created it. To leave it can't be done in that way. He needs someone else to do it.
Mm.
Outside, the others are dodging various orange explosions, being zapped at by the jail guards, and they're racing past in Bessie. That's just a little recap of what they're up to, because we go straight back to Omega and the Doctors. And the Doctors agree to help, believing that they don't really have any other choice.
That's right. Omega says that the first thing they need to do is to help him to remove his mask. And he says that they too will need such masks, as the light stream has a slow corrosive effect. But the process takes time, so that they'll be okay for now. But, you know, long term, they're going to need a mask. And he kind of sits down. The two doctors kind of wander over and start to try to take this mask off. There seems to be some sort of catches that they have to undo. And then they kind of lift up the faceplate. And then they step back aghast at what they can see. And Pertwee gently shuts the faceplate again. And they tell Omega that there's actually nothing left behind the mask. The corrosion's already taken effect. And there is nothing left of him.
Yeah, quite a creepy idea. And sure enough, he heads over to a mirror and actually takes a whole helmet off, doesn't he? Just lifts it off. And sure enough, there's nothing there. Which is quite a good effect, isn't it? It's CSO again. If you're being pernickety, it doesn't quite work because you can't see the back of his costume where the back of Omega's neck would have been, can you?
No.
But, yeah, that's nitpicking. But, yeah, it's quite a spooky idea, lifting it off and there being no head there.
Well, the only daft thing about this is if it's that easy to lift it off like that, why does he ask them to do it?
Yeah, it's definitely there for dramatic purposes. And how does he brush his teeth? Would he not notice that he hasn't got any teeth? Or a mouth?
Maybe he just wills them brushed and they're brushed.
That's good, isn't it?
But as you say, Omega exists only because his will keeps him alive. And basically, his will is all that's left of him. He replaces the mask and he lets out this kind of horrible animal-like cry, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's not true! And he really goes into one. He starts banging on about being the creator again, and that as well as the creator, he can also be a destroyer. So he must exist.
Yeah, it gets a bit existentialist, doesn't it?
This yeah.
Yeah, I create and destroy it, therefore I am. Trout reminds me that, you know, you do, but you can only exist here. You can't exist anywhere else, so therefore it's pointless you're trying to escape. But Omega counters this by saying if he only exists because of his will, then his will is to destroy. All things shall be destroyed. And then you get a sort of wobbly effect on the screen and the camera rocks from side to side and the doctors leg it.
That's the point where his mask flaps open, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
When he's raging away. He's saying such things so violently that the mask actually flaps up.
Yes.
You don't actually see anything beneath. So it's not quite a Pyramids of Mars moment. But
No, I think he's got sort of black gauze or something over his face, isn't he, underneath?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. Obviously, everything's going a bit tempestuous in Omega's world. And the doctors take this opportunity to leg it out of the room. They find the exit immediately, don't they, without the aid of the flowers that the others use. You get an exterior shot, don't you, of them running away from Omega's palace door. And you get Troughton's fantastic sort of flapping run. They've both got distinctive runs, haven't they? Because Troughton's got that one with his sort of knees pointing outwards.
Yeah, knees up run.
Yeah, whereas Pertwee's stride is far too short, isn't it? He does this range sort of tiptoeing run, doesn't he?
Yeah. The Brigadier and co. make it back to Unit HQ. They're all talking at once, aren't they? The Brigadier tells them to shut up. And then they hear gunfire, and the doctors arrive, obviously being shot at by the jail guards. Whereas the Brigadier and the others have been driving their own Bessie for quite some time, the doctors arrive a few seconds after them, don't they? Having run all the way there.
Well, we've seen both of their efficient running techniques. So of course, they're going to cover a lot of ground very quickly.
They all dive into the TARDIS and whack the force field back on as jail guards appear outside and surround it.
Yes, Omega, meanwhile, is watching all this on his monitor screen, saying that they'll be back begging for mercy, but by then the universe will no longer exist. Mm. Back with the Time Lords, they're still fretting about their power drain, which is almost complete now. And they realise that they're not really going to get the First Doctor to the other two. He's really going to just continue to be able to observe and advise and not do anything else.
Yeah, so they're trapped inside the TARDIS. Troughton's still looking for his recorder. She seems to be doing it all the time in the story. But there is a good plot reason for it, as we're about to find out. Mm. The Brigadier says that they should be thankful for small mercies that he can't find it.
Yes.
Troughton looks a bit aggrieved, doesn't he? Tyler, of course, is very impressed by the inside of the TARDIS, but he says that he doesn't want to stay there forever. And Benton also says that with two doctors, they should have twice as many ideas as to how they're going to nobble Omega. And then Hartnell appears on the scanner again, and this time he suggests that the three of them put their heads together to find a solution, and we get the now monotonous contact. And this time it's the three of them. The image flashes between three faces. And at the end of it, they say that they all agree, and Hartnell goes back to report to the Time Lords. Somehow, Hartnell can go back and forth between the two universes somehow.
He's not really in the antimatter universe, is he? I think he's just on a screen. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I mean, he's only on a screen for either part, isn't he, for the Time Lords or the two Doctors. So, yeah, so probably okay. A couple of interesting things about this scene. One is before Hartnell appears on the screen, a buzzer sounds, doesn't it? And the Third Doctor thinks someone is trying to get through to them. And then you see Troughton say, "You don't think," and then points upwards. And the Third Doctor says, "I hardly think so." And I'm not really sure what he's getting at there. It's almost like thinking, "Oh, you don't think it's God trying to contact us, too?"
Yeah, I mean, I think that is what it's supposed to be. I mean, but it's ridiculous. It doesn't fit in with anything, does it? It's bizarre.
There's no place for God in the Doctor universe. It's never even been mentioned, hardly. You know, someone might have used it as an oath every now and then, but that has never been confronted, that one. So I just thought it was a very odd scene, that. The other point I was going to make about this scene was it would be nice if the First Doctor had said contact as well, because he doesn't, does he? Doctors 2 and 3 say, I mean, he's in there with the alternating faces, isn't he? It goes to a three-way, as you say, but it'd be nice if he'd said contact as well. But he might be given scripts before that part was added to Troughton and Pertwee's scripts.
Mm. Anyway, they've all agreed some sort of plan. Hartnell disappears, as we say, and then they decide they're going to release the force field to the dismay of the others, because, of course, it's going to leave the TARDIS defenceless. And then the two Doctors, they start crawling around underneath the console. We get some more bits with Joe telling the Brigadier that the old chap on the scanner was another Doctor. Brigadier's asking Pertwee what they're up to. And Troughton finds his recorder, which has fallen into the force field generator somehow. And he goes to sort of grab it, but Pertwee stops him and says, no, it's just what we need. Because it's inside this force field generator, it hasn't been converted. Although, did we find that out yet? We don't find that out yet, actually, do we?
No, but that's obviously what's going through the Third Doctor's mind, isn't it?
Mm.
The Second Doctor's reluctant to sacrifice his recorder, but the Third Doctor says he'll get him 1,000 of them in return.
Mm. Hartnell, meanwhile, is reporting back to the Time Lords. Troughton pulls the force field generator out. It appears in kind of like a box, doesn't it? And it's got the recorder inside it. Yeah, they're going to take this so they can go and bargain with Omega. They use the TARDIS monitor to contact Omega. And he appears on the scanner and they tell him that they've found a way to help him. And they ask him to release the TARDIS so that they can actually fly it over to the palace. He suspects that they're trying to escape, but they just say that they, you know, all they want to do is avoid having a long walk.
Yes. So Omega agrees with this, and the TARDIS materialises in his singularity chamber. They tell him they've come to set him free as long as the humans are set free. Omega agrees to their freedom and to spare the universe as well, but as he believes that he can't be set free because of the fact that he no longer really exists, he says that in return the Doctors will have to stay with him and share his endless exile with him. The Third Doctor agrees, but in a very carefully worded way, he says they won't try to leave this world before he does.
So Omega agrees to let the others go. Pertwee tells them all to step through the column of smoke, that is the singularity, and that it will take them all home. So the Brigadier takes over at this point, and he tells Hollis to go first, but Hollis refuses. But Tyler steps forward, and he says he'll do it. So he goes through, he steps through this column of smoke, and he just disappears. Hollis obviously feels that having seen Tyler do it, it's okay, so he goes next. And then Benton, who kind of half-heartedly tries to object, but the Brigadier orders him through. And then it's Jo's turn, and funnily enough, she wants to stay with the Doctor. And makes a big fuss about it, but he tells her that she needs to go. And finally, she does. And then the Brigadier is the last one, and he turns and salutes them and then steps through. So they've all gone.
Yeah, in one of the most ponderously slow scenes of any Doctor Who story ever.
Yeah, it's a bit like the finale to the Five Doctors, isn't it, where they all go off, you know, say goodbye to each other and they go into the TARDIS one by one and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very, very slow. Unfortunately, it's not helped, is it, by the fact that it's on a kind of raised dais, isn't it, this plume of singularity smoke, and it's quite a clumpy sort of wooden set. And you can hear the actors walking up and then going through this singularity disappearing, and then you can still hear them walking off the other side of the day. But never mind. The Second Doctor offers Omega the force field generator. Omega is distrustful of this childish contraption, But the Second Doctor says it's the only freedom Omega can ever have, and again asks him to take it. He then tries to do a quick sort of mind meld with the Third Doctor, doesn't he? But Omega just laughs in his face. And then the Third Doctor gets quite angry and just shouts at him to take it. And Omega gets, in turn, even angrier that anyone should order him to do anything in his world. And he knocks the generator out of the Second Doctor's hands in rage. And then the screen whites out, and we see the black hole explode and then disappear.
Yeah, as the box falls towards the floor, Troughton shouts, run, doesn't he?
Mm.
And they turn to run back to TARDIS, but you would think that they wouldn't make it before it hit the floor.
Yes.
But of course they do. You get a close-up of Omega's face bleaching out, don't you?
Mm.
And as you say, you see a bright light appear and explode outwards. At the time I was watching all this on the screen, the black hole is replaced by what looks a bit like the Milky Way, really. There's apparently is a supernova. And their lights and power all come back on, don't they?
Mm.
So clearly it's worked and the universe is saved.
Yeah, ironically, the Time Lords have a new source of energy with this supernova, so Omega's done it again, basically.
Yeah.
Only this time without wanting to. So the humans land back in the unit lab doing the same simultaneous jump edit trick that we saw earlier. Benton looks out the window and confirms that they are actually back on Earth. They're not just stuck in HQ in the antimatter world. And then, of course, they think, well, the doctors aren't here. And Joe starts crying. And the Brigadier says, a wonderful chap, both of him. Which, of course, is a reprise slightly differently in the five doctors again.
Yeah. And then, of course, the TARDIS appears and the doctors come out. Everyone's all relieved. Ollis appears back down by the reservoir in the wildlife reserve by where the weather balloon had zapped him earlier. Pertwee's explaining that once Omega's will was gone, everything just snapped back into its proper place. So, you know, they all appeared back in the unit lab and the doctor's back in the TARDIS and Ollis back in the wildlife reserves. And then he explains about the fact that the recorder being inside the force field hadn't been converted by the antimatter blob. And so when it touched the antimatter universe, the, you know, matter and antimatter exploded, turning the black hole into a supernova.
Mm. So that's all good stuff, except for the Second Doctor who bemoans the loss of his recorder with its lovely tone.
Yeah.
Yes, they then hear an old man muttering in the TARDIS, and they go in to find the First Doctor on the monitor screen again. And as he does in, or Richard Herndl does as the First Doctor in The Five Doctors, he calls them young men, doesn't he? Mm. You young men. And he wonders how they'll ever get by without him. Then there's all this, the usual, so nice to meet me and all the rest of it type of stuff. And worse still, the Second Doctor, you know, sort of says his goodbyes and disappears. And Joe says, oh, pity, he was so sweet. And the Third Doctor says, yes, wasn't I? And then does this terrible double take of Joe.
Yeah, never mind. The Brigadier's telling Benton to go and do a full inventory of Unit HQ to make sure that everything's back in its place. Tyler also takes his leave, saying something along the lines of, he's really enjoyed it, but I don't think he's going to write it up because nobody would believe him.
He wants to keep his job.
Yeah. Pertwee's a bit sad about Omega. You know, you get the usual kind of sentimentality with him and Joe. And then as they're talking, you hear the dematerialisation noise and a new dematerialisation circuit appears on the console and the Doctor gets his memories back. So the Time Lords have finally forgiven him and given him his freedom again. Joe's worried that he's going to rush off, but he says, oh, you know, I'm not going to get straight away.
Meanwhile, Ollis arrives home and his West Country wife asks him where he's been. You know, that everyone's been out looking for him and there's been big fuss while he's been away. And he just says, oh, you'll never believe me, and asks whether his supper's ready. And that's the end. It's a very similar kind of relationship with Sam Seeley and his wife, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where's my grub woman?
Yeah, that's it. Pretty good, I think.
Hmm. An enjoyable romp?
Yeah, it was. I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to, actually. You know, the stuff that kind of annoys me about it a little bit is all the references to, you know, being the same person, etc., etc. But I think it's just because we've seen it so many times in other stories as well, and so it grates a bit. But, you know, you have to bear in mind that this was the first story of this kind, so it was all fresh then.
Yeah, that side of things was certainly new ground, wasn't it? There's a few interesting notes about this, if I just rattle through them. The original script was called Death World, and it's a really convoluted story that begins with Death playing chess with the King of the Time Lords. There's all sorts of weird stuff goes on in it, and there's, you know, zombies, and the doctors end up in the caves of hell, and all sorts. Terence Dick's script editor said this wasn't suitable for Doctor Who, and he gave him the idea of perhaps an exiled Time Lord on an antimatter world, and they kind of, Bob Baker and Dave Martin ran with that one. Omega's name was originally going to be Ohm, O-H-M, because that is the word that you get if you turn Who upside down, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But it turned into Omega, which is a better name, I think, the last letter of the Greek alphabet, of course.
Yeah.
Fraser Hines as Jamie was to have appeared in the story, but he couldn't get out of his Emmerdale farm duties, you know, mucking out the sheds, I suppose. And Wendy Pabry as Zoe Herriot was also unavailable to take his place in the script. And this is why you get quite a lot of time with the Second Doctor and Sergeant Benton, because a lot of those lines would have been Jamie's originally.
Okay.
Which is quite good for the Benton character, because he fleshes out a little bit, and he doesn't get a lot to say normally. So that was good for him and for John Levine playing him. The TARDIS console was redesigned for this story, because we last saw the console in the Time Monster, the last story of the previous season. And the actual sets had warped in storage, and apparently Barry Letts, the producer, didn't like them anyway. So they were redone based on drawings of the first ever TARDIS console, the one used in Unearthly Child. So there's a few extra bits and pieces in there we don't normally see at this stage in the show. And there's that slightly sort of perspexed off area, isn't there, that you get in the first TARDIS console, which appears in this one. You just see it doesn't get used or anything at all in this one. But it makes you wonder why, if that's the case, and it's been redesigned during the colour era, why is it still that pale green colour, which they used to have in the black and white era, because white used to flare off the cameras. I don't know if that was still happening at that stage in the history of the BBC or not, but I mean, it's still green, whereas you would think by this stage it wouldn't have to be.
Yeah, interesting. But yeah, they keep this one until Mask of Mandragora, don't they, when we switch to the secondary control.
Yeah, it gets a white paint job there at some point, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Before then, yeah.
But it's the same, so...
That's right, yeah, it is. Another myth, we exploded the myth about the Troughton's little inset, didn't we? There's a common misbelief that Hartnell's scenes were shot in his garage. They weren't. They were shot at Ealing Studios. Mm. So I don't know where that one came from. Do you want to talk about ratings?
Can do.
Yeah, I know, we're never really that interested. But as it goes, episode 1, 9.6 million. Episode 2, 10.8 million. Episode 3, back down to 8.8 million, most of the story. And then finishing episode 4 on the highest ratings for the story, which is 11.9. This story was repeated during the Five Faces of Doctor Who strand that they showed in 1981. The first episode was shown on the 23rd of November 1981. A significant date, of course. And in terms of ratings, they got about 4.5 million to 5.8 million per episode, which for a repeat on BBC Two at that time...
Pretty good.
...that day was considered pretty healthy. Mind you, by that stage, people were starved of old Doctor Who, weren't they?
Mm, definitely. We hardly anything, didn't we? Yes, the dark days.
Indeed.
Yeah, interestingly, you mentioned that the repeat being shown on the anniversary. Of course, this is billed as the 10th anniversary story, isn't it?
Yes.
It was actually broadcast very shortly after the 9th anniversary, bizarrely.
It started on December the 30th, I think, didn't it?
Yeah, 1972, so...
Yeah.
A bit strange, but there you go.
So
what do we think of it overall? What's your overall thoughts?
It's enjoyable, isn't it? From a plot point of view, I think it's a pretty interesting, decent enough plot. I think Omega is an interesting character. He's scary and tragic in equal measure, I think.
Mm.
We get a really decent payoff, I think, with the the recorder being protected, matter in an antimatter world, and that protection being lost when the generator was dropped. It was a nice ending rather than just some feeble Deus Ex Machina and all the rest of it.
Mm.
I agree that it's hard to believe that doctors could have got away quickly enough to avoid being part of the whole annihilation themselves, but that's life and that's Doctor Who. I think it's good that we learn a little bit more about Time Lord Society, don't we? At least from Omega's point of view. But there's still a fair amount of mystery there, I think.
Yeah. Well, we learn a lot about their history, don't we? We don't learn a lot about their society as such, because we just see them in a control room losing power, and they don't do a lot, do they? But yeah, I mean, the whole backstory about Omega and how he created or he tamed the black hole and created time travel for the rest of the Time Lords. It's all good stuff.
Yeah, it is. Some classic sort of unit stuff, isn't there? Always good fun seeing them trying to shoot aliens. So that was good. But I think the whole thing is quite a return to form, really, because before that, at the end of the last season, you'd had the mutants and the Time Monster. And by that stage, you must have been thinking, it's about time for the show to end, I think. And oddly, I think it's Troughton that really brings new life to the show, doesn't it? Even though he was a part of its history. I mean, he really steals the show, doesn't he, I think, in this?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he's superb at it. I guess we ought to look at each of the Doctors in turn, but, Troughton puts in a cracking performance. It's almost like he's not been away, really. It's only been a couple of years, I guess, since he was in the role.
He's superb. I mean, he just shows what an excellent actor I think he is. He's all, some of the little nuances he delivers throughout. I think this could be one of his best ever performances as the Doctor, actually. Really good stuff.
Yeah, and Pertwee as well is very good in it, I think. He plays the straight man, really, doesn't he?
Yes.
Troughton's tomfoolery, and I like all the interplay between them. I like them arguing, actually. I don't like all the you and me and he is him and all that malarkey, but the fact that they argue with each other, I think, is a good idea.
It's good fun, isn't it? It makes that relationship more interesting. And they are quite different, aren't they? Because by now, in the stage of the show, the Third Doctor's eccentricities are pretty much ironed out by now, aren't they? He's quite whimsical, isn't he, in Speared from Space, but not really much after that, and certainly not by this stage, where he's pretty much a straight action hero, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, yeah. But yeah, I think they're both really good. Hartnell, as we said earlier, is I think he's fine in it. It's just a shame that he's limited to the scenes just being shot on his own, really, in this kind of time eddy.
But
he puts in a good performance, and it's nice to see him.
Yeah, it is. It's good stuff. No complaints about him. I did think there's a little too much recorder stuff going on for the Second Doctor, because it's not really a big part of his characterisation. There's a little bit in the Power of the Daleks, isn't there? But I didn't really see much after that. I know it's integral to the whole denouement of this story, but it's still not a big part of Doctor Who's character, is it? But you can forgive it because of the plot reasons, I think.
Yeah, it does get on your nerves a bit after a while. But it does give a few comedy moments, like the fact that he is banging on about it all the time. It's the other people's reactions to that that make it worthwhile.
Yes, it does. Now on to the other regulars. Katie Manning as Jo Grant is, as ever, really. I mean, she's the best will in the world. She's not the greatest actress, but her sort of charm gets her through, I think.
Yeah, I think she's a bit underused in this one. There's a lot to fit in. You've got two lead characters, effectively. So everybody else is going to get a smaller role, aren't they?
Yes.
And I think she kind of loses out more than others because the Brigadier comes more to the fore, and Benton, as you mentioned earlier. So, there isn't a great deal for her to do other than, as we're saying throughout, that wherever the Doctor goes, she has to follow.
Yes. Yeah, as we've said, Benton gets quite a good story, I think, doesn't he? By virtue of the fact that he gets a lot of Jamie's lines, doesn't he? And becomes a sort of surrogate Jamie, doesn't he, for the story, spending so much time with the Second Doctor. Brigadier, I think, is good and bad in this one. He's a bit sort of daft in places. I can't understand why he doesn't believe stuff yet. How long has he been involved with the Doctor, yet still sort of incredulous about everything?
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I think he gives a good performance,
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very good, in fact.
But, yeah, character-wise, it doesn't do him any favours. He appears like a buffoon, really. But, he does get a lot to do, and he gets some funny lines.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's pretty good. Ollis is pointless. I don't know why they bothered with that, really.
Well, I suppose it brings the mystery to UNIT, doesn't it, the fact that he's just disappeared like that. But you could imagine Tyler just coming up with his bizarre readings he's been getting and just presenting that to UNIT, but I suppose dramatically it's not as interesting.
No, I guess. Yeah, and then I suppose Tyler himself, who, to start with, I thought, he was quite a good character, really, and when he's looking at the X-ray plate things and his first couple of scenes, he's pretty good, but then he just becomes a bit of a, I don't know, his reactions to what's going on just don't seem right to me.
Yeah, he's a bit sort of underwhelmed by all this amazing stuff going on around him, isn't he? But I suppose you could say that he's looking at things with a sort of cold scientific eye and just trying to understand them. And he does thank the Doctor for a fascinating trip, doesn't he, at the end. The escape thing is a bit daft. It just seems a bit out of character for him to attempt to escape like that, and it's, you know, not the fault of the character, because that's just something that it had to do to fill out some time.
Yeah.
Dennis Palmer as Corporal Palmer is unintentionally funny in several places.
Yeah, he's hilariously bad, but yeah, it's good that he's in it.
It is, yeah. The Time Lords, I think the President, Roy Purcell, is really good, quite a sort of commanding presence. And Graham Leman is the unnamed Time Lord working the screen rather than Richard Stilgar. As we said, Clyde Pollitt, there's a chance that he's a bit odd with his high piping voice. But I think he's a good example of how we come to think of the Time Lords as being a bit sort of prissy.
Mm.
And he's very sort of slippery shouldered as well, isn't he? As soon as things look like they're going to go a bit pear-shaped, he tells the President it's all on his head, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's the sort of character traits that particularly, I suppose, the Third and Fourth Doctors are complaining about the Time Lords being like that.
Mm.
So that's quite a nice bit of characterisation, I suppose, although a bit unintentionally funny, as we say. But we haven't mentioned the third, well, I suppose fourth key Time Lord in this, and that's Omega.
That's right. I mean, Stephen Thorne plays him. He's excellent. Yeah, it's really, really good. Really good character. I think he puts in a great performance. Great thundering voice. Swiftly turning from anger to even more anger.
Yeah.
And I think he's really good.
Yeah, he evokes some sympathy as well, doesn't he? He's quite a tragic character, as I say. Obviously, Stephen Thorne's a big bloke and has a very tall headpiece, isn't there? So he's quite an impressive stature for the character. But I think Stephen Thorne's body language throughout is really good, because he's got no facial language to work with, has he?
Right.
So he's just got a voice and body language, and I think he does a really good job with those limitations. He does charge around sometimes like a sort of angry child, doesn't he? Which I think works quite well with his sort of anger.
Mm-hmm.
On to the sets. We've said Omega's world looks like the Severum pantomime. Other than that, I think the rest of it is all right, really.
Yeah, there isn't a lot else, though, is there? I mean, we got the unit lab, which is, you know, is the unit lab. What else have we got? There's not much else, is there?
Well, it's a Time Lord control room, which I think is
quite
impressive.
Yeah, it's okay. I wouldn't say it's impressive.
I like the sort of screens and stuff in the background. I thought it had quite a plush feel to it.
You think?
Well, maybe I'm easily pleased.
I wouldn't use the words impressive or plush to describe it myself.
Fair enough.
You know, I would have said it was adequate.
Okay.
That's about it. I thought it would look a bit cheap, to be honest. Yeah, it was okay. It wasn't awful, but I definitely wouldn't call it clutch.
All right, whatever. Special.
Might be compared with your house.
Although I have tried to model it on Omega's world.
What do you mean? It doesn't really exist.
Yes, it exists only in my head. It's actually a cardboard box underneath a bridge. Special effects, we've said some slightly primitive CSO, which is odd because in Claws of Axos was a couple of years earlier, and I thought they'd handled CSO mostly extremely well in that one.
Well, it goes all over the place, CSO in Doctor Who, doesn't it? I mean, you know, you go on several years to things like Underworld, my God.
Yeah, I don't know if it depends on how much time they have to do the effect or who's directing it or who's in charge of special effects at the time, but yeah, you're right, it's not very consistent. We talked about the black hole and lightning strikers not being that wonderful. Omega's model doors were good.
But not up close.
Yeah, but not up close. I like the zapping effect, the blob.
Mm.
And I like the mind meld effect, really, that flicking to from each actor's face. I thought was pretty good. That leaves the gel guards.
Yeah, they were excellent. My favourite ever monster.
Sorry, I think there's a bad line.
I said they're rubbish. My worst ever monster.
All right, yes, good. That's better. Normal service resume. Yeah, all right, stationary, I think, but not very good when they move. And, yeah, the sound design is a bit strange as well.
They kind of let it down a bit, as to some Omega's Palace set is not particularly good. But, yeah, overall, though, it was much, much better than I thought.
Okay.
Than I remembered it. I always think of the Three Doctors as being fairly poor, but I definitely changed my mind watching it this time.
Hmm.
I think it's pretty good. It's got some strong ideas in it.
Definitely, yeah.
And, you know, it's not perfect, but it's, you know, I like it, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's good. I particularly like the stuff on the antimatter world. I thought it's really good the way that all these kind of unit objects appearing dotted around the place. I think it's quite a sort of fascinating idea, really. And, I think the whole thing works really well as a whole.
Mm.
A quick word on incidental music. It's the usual primitive synthesizer stuff from Dudley Simpson, which is happening quite a lot in this stage of Pertwee's reign, isn't it? Although there is some, I thought, some really nice sort of magical music when they first get to Omega's palace, which I think was there to try and help you forget how unmagical the sets were. But it does add a little sort of frisson to those scenes, I think. Yeah, it's adequate, I'd say, the incidental music on this one.
Yeah. Just a couple of anomalies with the stories. Why hasn't Omega removed his hat before? Like, as you said, doesn't even brush his teeth or whatever. But you think you would know. Does he keep his hat on all the time? I know he said something about the corrosive effect of this light beam, but he's not had that light beam going all the time, has he?
No, I don't think he has. It's only in the last, since the story began, really, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, it's been scanning the Earth, they say, don't they? But we don't know how long. I don't think that crops up, doesn't it, occasionally? There's that terrible scene in Android Invasion, isn't there, where that character has had an eye patch on. And then he takes the eye patch off and realises he had a working eye there all the time. Which is absurd.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these things happen. But it's dramatic effect, isn't it?
And the other thing is, why, rather than just going out and seeking revenge, why hasn't he ever asked for help? Obviously, he can send things through the black hole. He could have waved and sort of said, you know, I'm here, come and get me.
Yeah.
Rather than do that, he just tries to destroy him.
Sat there and sulked. Yeah, I never thought of that. But, that's perhaps another thing that could have been talked about. Yes, so we got some interesting feedback on this one. And let's start with our first ever bit of audio feedback.
Wow.
Yes, this is from Jeff Walker. So here's Jeff.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Martin. It's Jeff Walker here from the Goodies Podcast. I'm a long-term listener to the Crinoid Podcast, but a first-time writer. First bit of feedback, and it's mainly because when I heard you were doing The Three Doctors, I just could not resist. It's my absolute favourite Doctor Who story of all time, and it's mainly because of the interplay between Pertwee and Troughton, not so much in their scenes together, but the way they balance the entire story out. Now, I know a lot of people like to trash The Three Doctors, and particularly the gel guards, things like that, but, you know, it's my favourite episode of Doctor Who, mainly hinging on the brilliance of the scene in which the Brigadier realises that the Second Doctor is back, and he's utterly baffled by it. It's a symphony of reaction shots. Just Nicholas Courtney's face is absolutely incredible, and when Troughton is trying to explain to Benton what's happening with the antimatter monster, or the transport glowy red thing, the dialogue's just absolutely brilliant. It's just perfectly delivered, and it's so much fun.
That's the problem with antimatter. You can see the effect, but never the cause. Try being punched on the nose by the Invisible Man.
And what's this stuff?
The Invisible Man. Antimatter.
But I thought you said that matter and antimatter couldn't meet without an explosion.
Yes, that's right.
So, it shouldn't exist here, but it does.
Yes. Awkward, isn't it? As far as I can see, there's only one explanation.
Yes?
For this stuff, or whoever sent it, is cleverer than we are. Unfortunate, isn't it?
And there's nothing that even you can do?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. We can make sure it stays harmless for a start.
Oh, that's a relief. Look, can I leave you to get on with that? Those other things are still outside there. I must contact Geneva.
Well, what are we going to do now?
Keep it confused. Feed it with useless information. I wonder if I have a television set handy.
Now, aside from all the Troughton parts and how much fun they are for the audience, it's beautifully balanced out by Pertwee, and he's lending a lot of gravitas to the whole story. He's just playing it straight, playing it serious, and that's what the story needs to balance things out. But overall, I could talk for hours about this, but overall, it's just a fantastic story, and even the last scene just sums it up really, really well, where Hollis returns home to his wife after all the completely bizarre things he's been through, and he's just po-faced about the whole thing. And when she's berating him, he just says, "You'd never believe me, woman." It's just fantastic.
And where do you think you've been, Arthur Hollis? I've been worried sick about you, I have. Everybody's been searching. Where have you been? Soldiers looking for you? You didn't come home for your dinner? Well?
You'd never believe me, woman. Supper ready?
And I think the best use for this episode is if people are new series fans and they do want to get back into other Doctors, this is the best place to start with Troughton, I think. Especially if you're taking in a bit of Pertwee, let's say you're working your way backwards through the Doctors. This is just brilliant colour Troughton, and it can really set you up for the earlier episodes, even though there are very few. But this is an absolute highlight of one, much better than The Two Doctors. But of course, The Two Doctors is an episode I really like as well. So I look forward to you guys doing that one. Keep up the brilliant work, and many thanks once again. I'll look forward to downloading all the future episodes. Cheers.
So thanks, Jeff, for that feedback. Audio feedback is always welcome, so anyone else out there wants to pop us an MP3, then feel free.
Cool. Next up, we've got some feedback from Mike Wemben, who says, great to have the first three Doctors together in the one story, even if poor old William Hartnell was obviously not having a whale of a time. The dialogue between the Doctors is great, with lots of humour, without being silly. It's however shame that the story was not very inspiring. To be sure, Omega is a good character, especially when he got all shouty and scary, a classic baddie. Another early story adds to the knowledge of the Time Lord history, which all works very well, but the rest of the story is pretty poor stuff, lots of running around with little suspense, no characterisations to speak of. The real triumph of the story is Troughton, who stole the show from under Pertwee's large nose. You've been doing the TARDIS up, don't like it. The characterisation seems to be even better than he managed during his regular run. Pertwee comes over as quite a boring old stick in the mud by comparison. Hartnell also does well, despite being stuck in his garden shed, and gets a few A's, M's, in for old time's sake. The other characters aren't too much to write home about. Mr. Ollis doesn't do much apart from look dated with his vile hairdo. The Professor looks stupid in a tweed jacket with elbow patches and a tash and glasses, just like a stereotyped idea of what a professor should look like. Although, come to think of it, he does look like Robert Winston. The regular characters are okay. Joe and Benton ask questions in all the right places and get captured, etc. The brig is appalling, though, having gone from being the thin green line that is holding back an extraterrestrial horde of invaders to becoming a disbelieving in any kind of UFO-type oddness. A sad way for the brig to go.
Yeah, it's the sort of beginning of the end for the Brigadier, I think.
Yeah, although, as we said, I don't think he's appalling. I think, you know, the character is going the wrong way, but I wouldn't say it's appalling.
Yeah,
but anyway,
tribal harsh, man.
The design on the show is rubbish. Omega's scary mask aside, the rest looks terrible. The jail guards look shoddy and gaudy. The corridors in Omega's palace are full of tinsel and look like what one imagines Noddy Holder's house looked like in 1973. Having said all that, I do like the story and watched it endlessly as a kid because my parents taped it for me on a Betamax. Don't laugh, it actually had better picture quality than the VHS.
Yes, it did.
I know, I had one as well. When it was on the Five Faces of Doctor Who repeat. I think it does get an easy ride because of its anniversary status.
Yeah, as does the Five Doctors, really. As I think we said during that podcast, I think you forgive these sort of anniversary multi-doctor stories a little bit. And it's perhaps easier to forgive this one than it is Five Doctors. But they are a bit of fun, aren't they? I suppose not to be taken quite so seriously as the others, perhaps. Yeah, good stuff. Thanks for that, Mike. We've also got some stuff from Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil is the main man of the Adventures in Time, Space and Music podcast. Now, that can be found at adventuresintimespaceandmusic.philip with two L's, WSERNA.com. You can also find that at the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance website as well. Now, he is a muso, a trained musician, and lectures in musicianship as well. And his podcasts are all about the incidental music used in Doctor Who, and it's a fascinating listen, so download that. But he's given us some feedback on The Three Doctors. He said, while wrought with production problems, an ailing William Hartnell, and interestingly realised jail guards... cough, cough, crap design, cough. Even with an over-reliance on CSO, there are some interesting elements nonetheless. Omega is a tragic character, probably the best addition to Gallifrey lore until Robert Holmes' additions in The Deadly Assassin. Sometimes over the top, his portrayal is quite dramatic. Isn't the Time Lord Chancellor the sympathetic member of the Triumvirate in the War Games? That's Clive Pollitt we were talking about.
It is, yes.
Oh, it is him, all right, that's a good spot. He's similar to Bernard Horsfall, Dr. Phil reckons, Chancellor Goth and Deadly Assassin, and also one of the three. That's correct as well, he was. The Brigadier unfortunately becomes a source of comedy, albeit enjoyable in this story. Troughton is an apt equal to the pretensions of Pertwee's Doctor. Brilliant fun, and the Recorder's role in the plot's resolution is actually playful. Yeah, we were saying it got a bit sort of tiresome. I think the Recorder made its presence worthwhile by the end of it. So thanks, Dr. Phil, for those comments. And as I say, head to his website and download. It's always a good listen.
Good stuff. Okay, then. So we better give it some ratings, hadn't we?
We had better. Shall I go first this time?
Go on, then.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. As you said, it's better than I remembered it, because I didn't have great memories of it, to be honest. Although I always thought it was quite good fun, I suppose. But I think it's the ideas involved are, as we have said, really good, and a lot of the part they're well realised. You know, outside of its anniversary status, I don't think it would be considered a classic necessarily, but it's one of Troughton's best portrayals, I think. It's good stuff, and it's hard to imagine what it would be like to watch it having not seen the Doctors get together before. So that would have been an extra bit of icing on the cake, I think. But for me, I'd give it a 7 out of 10, all in all.
Well, I'm going to have to be boring and agree with you.
Yeah,
I'd give it a 7 as well, for more or less the same reasons. I used to think that I didn't like this story, and it surprised me when I watched it this time that it's a lot better than I remembered, and fully deserving of a 7. But I agree, it's not an absolute classic, and there are things wrong with it, as we pointed out, but it's really enjoyable to watch. There's enough going on in it. It's great ideas, great villain. Mm. And, Troughton, as you say, steals the show. Yeah, good stuff.
Excellent. Okay, so that's a 7 from both of us. So, what next? Well, the answer is The City of Death. We're going all the way back to 1979 for The City of Death. We haven't done any sort of later Tom Baker, and that has been noted by one of our listeners, Nick Davis, who suggested that era, and City of Death in particular, is one that we should cover. So that's what we're going to be doing next time. An interesting story, considered by many to be an absolute classic, but not without its faults, I would say. So it should make for an interesting podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it again. I know that one quite well, actually. So, as you say, it's banded around as one of the all-time best. I've never quite felt the same about it, but we'll see what we find as we watch it.
Yes, indeed we shall. So, if you've got any thoughts on The City of Death, then please get in contact with us in the usual channels. Email us at crinoid@mail.com or head to our blog pages at crinoid.blog.co.uk. There you will find, on the left-hand side, at the top of that opening page, you will find a link to our Facebook page, where you can also leave feedback on the show. We'll set up a discussion forum for it. And you can also get hold of us on Twitter. You can tweet us or follow us. We are at Crinoid on Twitter. So we look forward to hearing from you, whichever method you choose to contact us.
Wonderful. Let's wrap this nonsense up and say goodbye.
Yes. So thanks very much for listening, stroke downloading this one. And we hope to have your company again for the next one, The City of Death. So thanks very much. It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time.
Since Martin and I recorded the discussion for this podcast, we heard the sad news of the death of Nicholas Courtney, the Brigadier. We'd like to dedicate this podcast to him, and Dr. Phil from the Adventures in Time, Space and Music podcast has created this tribute to the great man.
Nicholas Courtney, most known for playing the now-retired Brigadier of the United Nations Intelligence Task Force, Sir Alistair Gordon Lethbridge-Stewart, passed away on the 22nd of February 2011 after a prolonged battle with cancer. Beloved by fans for both his warmth and his advocacy of the show, both during its initial run and after the classic series ended in 1989, Courtney appeared in 102 televised episodes of Doctor Who, the 1990s special Dimensions in Time, many Big Finish audio productions, as well as the Brigadier's final on-screen appearance in the 2008 Sarah Jane Adventures story, The Enemy of the Bane. As part of the UNIT family in the 1970s, and although he'd never had the opportunity to travel in the TARDIS as a companion, on screen anyway, the legacy that Courtney's Brigadier has had on the show can still be felt in the current revival series, since Doctor Who returned to our screens in 2005. It had been intended that he would appear alongside David Tennant's Doctor in the Sarah Jane Adventures 2009 story, The Wedding of Sarah Jane Smith, but alas, his ailing health had already begun to make future appearances impossible. It is with great sadness we say farewell to Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge-Stewart and the actor who brought him to life, as the Brigadier has gone to Geneva for the last time. In remembrance, and to celebrate his lasting legacy in Doctor Who, here are some of the Brigadier's many fine moments in The Three Doctors.
Take the cap! Brigadier, leave it alone!
It's not dangerous for the moment. It seems to think it's achieved its mission.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Yes, but you're not the...
Yes, it is, sir. It's the first one.
How are you, Brigadier?
Pretty well, thanks.
Doctor, what the blazes are you doing? Why have you changed your appearance? And what's happened to Miss Grant?
Just tell me this. Are you or are you not the doctor that I met during the Yeti business? And then later, when the Cybermen invaded?
Of course I am. You can see that.
Right, but then you subsequently appeared on Earth during that trouble with the Autons, only then you changed into a tall, thin fellow.
Had I really? How fascinating.
I warn you.
It's no use your asking me about all this, Brigadier. As far as I'm concerned, it hasn't happened yet. Don't you see? I'm just a temporal anomaly.
You've been mucking around with that infernal machine of yours, and somehow or other you've changed back your appearance and shot poor Miss Grant off to heaven knows where.
It's not quite as simple as that, sir. Honestly.
Now, that'll do, Benton. Now, just two things I want from you, Doctor. An effective way of controlling that stuff, and the safe return of Miss Grant.
Well, what about our doctor, sir? Don't you want him back?
None of that nonsense, Benton. I've got him back. As long as he does the job, he can wear what face he likes.
Well, I'll do my best, but I can't make any promises.
Well, in that case, you better consult those all-powerful superiors of yours for their advice.
Oh, I don't think that'll do any good. At the moment, they're far from being all-powerful. That's why it's been left up to me and me and me.
So this is what you've been doing with unit funds and equipment all this time. How's it done? Some sort of optical illusion?
Oh, no. They come like this, really.
Yeah.
Hey, Doc, let's go berserk out there.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
All right, now we're in here. What do we do?
Well, we have a think. Care for Jerry, baby.
Now, see here, Doctor, you have finally gone too far.
I'd rather think we all have. What's it like out there?
Well, there's sand everywhere.
Oh, splendid. Who's for a swim?
Do you realize what you've done? You've stolen the whole of Unit HQ. Now, what am I going to tell Geneva? That the whole blessed building has been picked up and put down on some deserted beach? We're probably miles from London.
I'm afraid we're a little bit further than that, Brigadier.
You mean we're not even in the same country? This could be construed as an invasion.
It's not just a matter of the same country, sir. The Doctor's right. We're not even in the same universe.
What? Oh, nonsense, Benton, I tell you, that's a beach out there. It's probably in Norfolk or somewhere like that.
Oh, please, if you'd only listen
right,
to me.
Right, now, I'll tell you what we'll do. You two stay here. See that nobody wanders in. We can't have the place overrun with holidaymakers. I'll nip out, find a phone, and tell the authorities exactly where we are. I'm fairly sure that's Cromer. Back in a jiff.
Seen my recorder anywhere, have you? It's a little thing about this long with holes in. I had it when I came in and I put it down somewhere and I thought.
The last time!
It.
Will you let me out of this madhouse?
There's no point!
I'm sorry, Doctor, but I'm afraid I must insist. My place is with the men out there, trying to do something about, well, this whatever it is out there. Not standing about here messing around looking for some damn fool flute!
Brigadier, I cannot open that door without first turning off the force field. And even if I did, you'd never make it across the floor. That thing out there has become a killer. It's my fault and I'm sorry.
Sorry?
All we can do now is think. And I think best music. Now, where is my recorder?
Oh,
people.
Locked.
What I don't
typical.
Understand is, what is your unit?
Just one moment, if you please. Now, wait a moment. You may be in a somewhat unusual situation, but you two at least are still supposed to be members of unit.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, sir.
Now, the question is this. What offensive action should we, or indeed can we, take against this chap, Omega? Now, in the absence of the doctors, it seems to me...
Sir, listen!
Sounds like a full-scale attack.
Maybe they're not firing at us. Maybe... It's the doctors!
Let's open the door.
Quick, get
them. Alice, come in! It's the TARDIS!
That old chap.
Afraid, sir.
Three of them. I didn't know when I was well off. Doctor!
Well, there you are, then. They can't get in.
And we can't get out.
We're besieged.
Oh, great.
If only I could find my recorder, I could play you a little something to pass the time.
We must be thankful for small mercies. Sonometan!
Sir?
You and I better make a full inventory of the HQ. Make sure everything's back in place. All gonna be accounted for, you know.
Sir?
Yes?
Well, excuse me, sir, but... Well, if anything is missing, where do we say it's gone?
Come along, Benton.
Now I've seen it all.
Pity. It was so sweet.
Yes, well, as far as I'm concerned, Doctor, one of you is enough. More than enough.
For those wishing to explore his career further in Doctor Who and elsewhere, I highly recommend his memoirs, the 1998 book Five Rounds Rapid, the 2002 audio memoir subtitled Soldier in Time, released by Big Finish, and his 2005 updated autobiography Still Getting Away with It, published with co-author Michael McManus. To honor the passing of such an important icon, I think it important to salute Courtney and his beloved character with both the traditional British military bugle call Last Post, but also to offer a salute befitting the Brigadier's most famous line.
Fire!